Hey, Project Big Screen listeners, you can find us every Monday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
Stella Blue Coffee is more than just great coffee. It's coffee with a purpose. Introducing We Brew to Rescue, a nationwide campaign using proceeds from our new ready-to-drink cans to help fund 1,000 pet adoptions this year. Every can you crack open helps a real pet find a real home. Simple as that. Made with 100% Colombian coffee, each 11-ounce can delivers smooth, drinkable energy with a boost of protein. Available in espresso cafe mocha and espresso sweet cream. Built for mornings, long days, and everything in between. Drink Stella Blue, fuel your day, and help save a pet's life. You can follow our progress in real time throughout the campaign by watching the adoption tracker on our site. Grab yours now at StellaBlueCoffee.com, Amazon, and select retailers nationwide.
Trust no one and accuse everyone. And Who's the Bad Guy? The official Barstool Sports social deduction game from the brilliant mind of Nick Tirrani. In what's quickly becoming the most popular new party game around, players are secretly assigned unique roles, with the good guys trying to expose the bad guys and the bad guys doing everything they can to stay hidden. Each game unfolds under alternating day and night phases, with roles like the cool chick, the shy guy, the gambler, El Presidente, the mentalist, the planner, the funny guy, and more. Every round is unpredictable, chaotic, and ridiculously fun. Who's the Bad Guy is great for parties, pre-games, family gatherings, or groups who just love deception-based games. Game night will never be the same. Shop now on Walmart.com.
On this episode of Project Big Screen, we have two reviews off the top. One for Tron Ares, and then Channing Tatum in Roof Man. And then the rest of the episode, we have a couple other smaller reviews for After the Hunt, Good Boy, and we talk about Peacemaker. Did we like the Peacemaker season 2 finale? Ocean's 14, what's happening with that? A couple trailer discussions, and we end it with the top 10 best threequels, a combined list for the best third movies in a franchise or series. All right, Project Big Screen, episode 2. Jeff D. Lowe, Kirk, Minahan, Clemmer, Ken Jack, Gooch, coming at you today for, look, this is, you got to sell a show. Not going to call it the most exciting slate of films ever released, but we're going to talk about them. Tron Ares, a franchise that they're just injecting life into, Roof Man, a couple trailers that we'll talk about, and then our top 10 list today, our combined top 10 list, top 10 best threequels, third movie in a franchise. Let's get right into it with Tron Ares. Recording this, by the way, for those who care, want to reference anything we say on October 12th, Sunday, October 12th, second episode here, Tron Ares off the top. Tron Ares follows a powerful digital being, Ares, played by Jared Leto, who was brought into the real world as part of an experiment to merge artificial and human existence. 1 hour, 59 minutes long runtime. Joaquim Ronning is the director, did Maleficent 2 and Pirates of the Caribbean 5.
The best one.
This is like a guy they have in the closet in Burbank that they pull out to do Disney movies. It's like the fucking strangest thing.
Unbelievable.
Legacy sequel. It is a sequel to Tron Legacy in the fact that it's called Tron. We will talk about that. Cast is Jared Leto, Greta Lee, achieved by Greta Lee with this one.
Oh, yeah.
Evan Peters, Jodie Turner-Smith, Hasan Minhaj, random, Arturo Castro, Gillian Anderson of The Crown. Great role in The Crown.
Damn great right. In The Crown.
Mm-hmm. Jeff X-Files, Bridges, baby. And X-Files. They didn't put it on the credits where I got this from. Gary Vaynerchuk. Gary Z in this movie.
Wow.
I did Gary notice v. him, yes.
More screen time than Cam Monahan.
Yeah, what the fuck? That was crazy.
That was kind of, I wonder when he found, you think he found out he got cut out of the movie in that moment or before it released? This is the big thing to talk about here. Music is by Nine Inch Nails. Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross. Actually, one of two movies they did that we're talking about today. Albeit the second movie we're going to talk about is much different, and it's them, not as Nine Inch Nails. $33.5 million on debut. We'll talk about the box office too. Rotten Tomatoes says it at 57% critics and 86% audience, so a huge split. Big difference. IMDb 6.7, Metacritic 48, Letterboxd 2.8. But what is the Kirk Minahan score. First up, Kirk, quick thoughts and score on Tron Ares.
I don't even know. It's a franchise that means nothing to me. The first one I don't care about. The second one I don't care about. This one I didn't even know. I'm old. I like didn't know what was going on. Like I needed somebody younger next to me. Like people my age should hire people to let me know what's going on in a movie like this. I was fucking baffled. I just know Greta Lee was like running around all the time. Like I don't know what she was sprinting around. It's not a story I care about. I could never get into it. Jared Leto I thought was not great. You know, I guess it looked good, I suppose. And obviously we'll talk about the music, which is why people go see Tron movies. I mean, this is like, I even just keep making these movies with different, was it Daft Punk last time? Is that right?
Am I right? Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're just going to keep doing it. Like 15 years from now, it'll be some other, and then 30 years, and it won't make any money. It's weird. They force this franchise down our throats. It never makes any money. Like mm-hmm. The last one lost money. I know it did, but it lost money for Disney. I don't know. 54? I thought it looked pretty good. I don't know, Clemmer. I thought it looked okay, but I'm not. This is just a franchise for me. I've never. And I don't like seeing, like, I want to see Jeff Bridges like being a real movie. You know, time's ticking here. We're losing people left and right. And Jeff Bridges is here in Tron being directed by this fucking guy. Like, I don't know. It's depressing. 52, actually. It's depressing me. 52.
Opened, I believe, with.
Yeah, I know. I just, yeah, Gooch, bum me. I'm not going to have two more points.
Yeah. I believe with the first one was 44 million opening. I think I have
no,
that right.
No. In 80, the first one in the 80s. No,
opening. Sorry. The last one.
Yeah. This made less than that. That's Kaczynski, right?
Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I there's a real popular Tron ride. I think it one of these Disney things. Maybe that's honestly part of it. Yep. Like it's like a lost leader or something. I have no idea. I don't know.
Ken Jack, what was your score?
Yeah, I landed on like a 65, not that much higher. And I think it's a movie where like you can potentially get exactly what you want out of it, depending on what you want out of it, because like it's big effects, good music and all like the surface level stuff is there for sure. But everything else is like very formulaic. Like if you watch any movies, if you watch like sci-fi movies specifically, like this has been like an endlessly regurgitated plot you've watched 5,000 times.
Oh, yeah.
And
right. Yeah, exactly.
Get the thing.
Right. Yeah, it's like the, you know, like when the mama bird like eats up the dinner to chew it up for its kids. Like this is that meal's been eaten 800 times and it's being regurgitated back into us. And I think like the big Achilles heel for this one is like it foundationally relies on you as the viewer being able to build empathy with Jared Leto. And that is functionally not possible. That is a huge problem for this movie. So again, surface level stuff's great. Everything else, it's fine. It's fine with all the other stuff.
What was your score?
65, I'm landing on.
65. Clemmer.
Yeah, I mean, this is Terminator 2.
Yeah.
Except in, like, what? Tron.
Whoa.
No, I agree.
I'm sorry. This is, like, Walmart.
A bad version.
Okay. I knew what you meant, but I couldn't let you continue on without clarifying.
The story, like, right, it's just the same story. Like, it's just, what, like, and there's actually, I think, a pretty effective scene in a parking garage. And it's like, all right, I was excited. But then like a minute after it's over, I'm like, wait a second. Like, bad guy running fast after, you know, robot sort of bad guy running fast. Like, we just did this in Terminator 2 like 30 years ago. So even, like, the best scenes of the movie are just, like, Ken Jack said, just, you know, just regurgitated stuff. I hope Greta Lee can made a ton of money, so she need to keep doing movies like this. It's not terrible, but it's so formulaic and so kind of just pointless. And the Jared Leto stuff just seems just so bizarre. Like, why is he in this movie playing this role? It was all very odd to me. I give it a 54. And I know we'll talk more about the later Tron movies, but this to me was a drop-off. And that was kind of my biggest takeaway.
Same garage as The Dark Knight? Was that the same one where I'm not wearing hockey pads? Looked exactly the same.
Did look like it.
I know garages aren't all that different, but it did look the same.
I don't think it's the same one as all the President's Men, I don't think. I think it's different from that.
Gooch, your score.
Yeah, 40 out of 100. 30 of those are for Nine Inch Nails. 10 of those are for Greta Lee's beautiful face. Nothing else. Like you all have already pointed out, just reheated nachos across the board, whether it's just like the aesthetics of the movie, the score of the movie, which I do love, but it's very clearly like, let's get another tech band in here to just revamp this thing. The themes of the movie, we've seen it a million times. The villain, fucking billion. We're doing the tech billionaire villain for the 50th fucking time this decade. We just keep going back to that well. It's dried up. Quit going there. A very frustrating movie all around. It's not terrible, but it pisses me off to know in that this is what they're spending $150 to $200 million on. Like, just what are we doing? What are we doing? Terrible.
Yeah, this bored me. I was pretty bored of this. I give it a 59. The music is kind of worth like 15, 20 points. I'll tell you what. Not a good sign when like the main leading marketing point is like, it's like a Nine Inch Nails music video. Like, oh, that's fine. Like, but that's not what it is. It's also not what it is. So, yeah, this was just, again, it was just kind of nothing. Like, it was over. It started and then it was over. And we'll spoil things in a second. No spoilers yet, but like kind of the entire premise of this movie is hinged on, like Ken Jack said, this character, this Jared Leto character, who I was kind of surprised, like, developed into the character. So I thought it was going to be, like, the main villain of the entire movie. Apparently I missed that. But if you miss, like, one moment on the screen that says, like, Jared Leto's character analyzes an empathetic response from Greta Lee's character, if you don't see that, you don't really know why he turns to like, be, like, a hero.
I don't even really know. I watched that.
So going forward, we will spoil it because I think you kind of have to go more spoilers. If you don't see that part of the movie, oh, you're kind of like, oh, I guess he's good now for some reason.
Well, Jeff, what if AI's malfunction was benevolence? What if?
It also, I also got to look. I don't want to get into the too much down the rabbit hole of Tron. And like the lore, I watched both of them. I watched the most recent one. Garrett Hedlund's character, not in this movie, doing literally anything else. Garrett Hedlund, his character goes into his dad's old office and gets sucked into the grid. Mm-hmm. And it's this cool, futuristic, new looking grid. But they get sucked in this one, and it's the first movie's grid, which I don't need to be consistent. That confused. I was very confused. I'm like, I think they're just doing this for the nostalgia. This doesn't seem to make much sense to me. So I don't think they know what the fuck's going on. It's kind of a sequel to the last one, but kind of isn't. They very aggressively tease Olivia Wilde's character and Garrett Hedlund's character at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. But I guess my big first question is, Kirk, you said you don't care. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's a unique take at this point. I think who fucking cares about this?
Nobody. I don't. The movie is terrible, but I could understand it if they rushed out a terrible movie for a franchise that people were that are dying to see. Like, we got to get this fucking movie out. We got to get Tron out October 2025. It's been 3 years. People are dying to see that one. So what, 15 years? Is that right? Yeah. 15 years. Nobody conversationally has talked about this. I don't know why this movie exists at all. It's going to lose money. I'm of an age where when the first one came out, like, none of my friends care about this movie. Like, nobody I know cares about this movie. It's strange. Like, if it was a great movie, great. But like, to wait 15 years and dump this shit, I don't even get it. I don't understand.
Mm-hmm. I think that's
been weird, for like, a theme park ride. I think it's like the second shortest ride in all of Walt Disney World. It's like a 20-second ride.
Right. Which, yeah.
Ken Jack, I guess devil's advocate. Jared Leto obviously is a big part of this. If you like Jared Leto in this, I guess you'll like this movie a little bit. I've seen some people say they like his like deadpan humor with the character. It didn't do much for me, but devil's advocate, do you get that? Does anyone here feel like, hey, you know, Leto, I don't know, Clemmer, do you think Leto's pushing Penn right now for supporting actor? Like, I don't know, like where do we where do we stand on
Clemmer? Thought, anyone you like thought Leto? He was better than Penn, yeah.
I don't think so. It's not really, it wasn't good Leto, like you had asked. It wasn't like horrible. Like, it almost felt like he was just kind of like, hey, when's this check coming through? It felt like he was just mailing this thing in. I know he'd been working on this movie for, he's been in production forever. His involvement's been in production for well over 5 years, I believe, with this movie. And I feel like he could give two shits. He cared less than the audience.
I'm weirdly, and I'm kind of in between spot with him, but I feel like this is the best performance he's had since Blade Runner 2049, but that's also the lowest bar. Like, it's so low that it doesn't really matter. So, I don't know. I'm kind of bummed out with him, and I think he was a bad choice for this character, where, again, the whole point of it is, like, you want to be able to build that that empathy of his, because he has this big hero switch from being the bad guy, which, by the way, if you're going to call him Ares, just call him Ares. Don't make him Master Control or whatever. Don't have the dual name. It's so stupid. But like I think you really need someone that you can build that with. And that Leto's just not the guy. And part of that's the off-screen stuff, but part of that's also just how he acts.
Nothing gets me more excited in a bad movie in like a franchise than a moment that like the filmmakers think is going to get the audience to cheer. When he calls the Jodie Turner Smith character Master Control, he's like, it's like, this is your task. And he pauses, Master Control. And yeah, it's like, oh yeah, it's on now, baby. Nobody cares. Like nobody. It is unbelievable. This is a bizarre. This is what I've talked about a lot of franchises on podcasts. This is one of the most bizarre ones there is. And again, it's like, it sets up another one.
This movie, which is a legacy sequel, they waited long enough for this to be actually technically a legacy sequel to a legacy sequel. Like that's how long the gap was.
Between, yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Legacy.
I did a marathon going into this movie. I watched the first two.
Disgusting.
Leading into it. And I actually didn't mind the second one. I think Kaczynski's great, and it did as much with that as you possibly could. The first one isn't very good. It's visually.
I like the second one leaps and bounds more than this one.
Yeah, me too. And I was like, what? I feel like a lot of the best parts of the second one were stripped out of this, the Tron Ares. And I'm just like, what? And honestly, even 15 years later, Tron Legacy looks better than Tron Ares, which is crazy. Other than the aging shit.
Yeah. It looks better. I think people, and I'm a defender of that movie, but I do think people too often, especially like younger people, will be like, oh, it's a masterpiece. It's peak. It's like, well, you're really glossing over some of the worst CGI we've had in the past 20 years in that DH.
They hang up on the music pretty heavily.
Yes. But you bring up, they strip the best things away. They went into the real world. The appeal of these Tron movies, if you're going to do it, is that built-in universe inside the game grid going inside, and they're going into the real world. Everything looks plastic now. It looked terrible.
First movie, I think, since Boys in the Boat, where I definitely fell asleep for a little bit. In the theater.
That's the Costner one, right?
Yeah. Oh, it's the Clooney one.
Oh, the Clooney.
Yeah, as a first, I think I slept for like 5 minutes because I woke up and I was a little – I don't think I missed that much, but yeah, I think
there's,
I fell asleep.
There's – if you told me there was 45 minutes of Hasan Minhaj typing in the intercom office, I would believe you. he's still hacking.
Yeah, it's just endless.
We went from Michael Sheen, who gives a really fun performance, to Evan Peters, one of the worst performances by a villain in a major movie that I can think of in a while.
Mm-hmm.
He's
from a
horrible.
Good actor, too. Like, he's a good actor.
Not here.
It's definitely a terrible character. It's a terrible character. Like, they keep
there
going.
There should be somebody at Disney, at Warner Brothers, at all these places that have IP, that their one job is to see in a screening of a movie, if it starts out with the exposition dump flashback like this to establish main characters, they should be like, nope, rewrite.
It's
try
how
again.
Long is that? It's like, what, like 20 minutes? I don't even know. It felt like it was endless. They knew they had a stiff here, right? When they released it this weekend, they knew they were dead.
Had to have.
I mean, this thing never had a chance. Never.
Like you don't have enough time to care about Evan Peters' character. You don't have enough time. No. Jared Leto's character does a couple like martial arts moves, and then the helmet comes off, and you're like supposed to really give a shit. And you can. That's not even Jared Leto's fault. Like that's just like, you're setting that up to fail off the top. It's like, why the fuck? Like, for me, it's like, if you're going to be this disconnected from the originals, just make a whole new thing. Just make a completely to force feed like, oh, well, Greta Lee's character is now buying the company. That's like, you don't like, no, it's like, you already have almost nobody from the last one. Jeff Bridges on a green screen somewhere or on the volume somewhere in LA. Like, you don't need to do all that. And I just think that was the biggest problem. Music was good though.
It was good. Some of the visuals.
It was good music. It was, and they Nine Inch Nails, like they were told to do something. They took the last movie, which they knew was successful. They did something kind of similar with their own twist, and that was cool. It sounds good. If this didn't have a good soundtrack score, this would be, I honestly got probably 20, 25 points. Like, it is the only thing that kept this thing like somewhat interesting, but it still had pockets of boringness. This is a pretty like not a shocking dud, but like a wow. I didn't know this. It could be this not fun. Some people think it's. By the way, I do think a lot. Like the five of us are kind of in a not the minority, but we're definitely on the lower end of.
Yeah, I don't have time for the conversation like 10 years from now when people say this is a masterpiece. I don't need that. I don't need that. I'm not going to – we're not – that's not
that happening. Was so deadpan,
yeah,
right?
Like, you don't get it. You don't understand what it's really about. Like, no, I do. I watched it. You know, yes, I get it.
You don't get it, Kirk. Her name was Eve, and she made a tree.
I didn't think of that.
So clever.
Arturo Castro, the guy from Broad City, being Greta Lee's boyfriend – some what? Usual casting. You literally had to have her say, "This is my boyfriend," because it was so fucking unbelievable that would happen. It didn't make any sense. He's out there making burritos, and she's a genius.
I thought that was fucking what's his face, John Higgins from Please Don't Destroy. On SNL for like 4 years. I honestly didn't realize it was him for like because he was in like a winter coat at first. I didn't see his full like hair and shit. I was like, is that him? What the fuck?
Yeah. I did like the ending where they just like tell you everything in the world got better, but they don't explain like how that was even possible. They're just like, yeah, well, AI just made the entire planet better. I know the half the lesson of this is that AI is bad and unchecked, but actually AI solves everything in the entire planet that went wrong. No further explanation needed. Like, okay,
orange trees.
We made orange trees, so yeah, everything's good now.
Orange trees that last longer than 29 minutes.
Yeah.
Actually, you know what?
29 minutes. Jesus, 29 minutes.
What the fuck was that?
It should be called the impermanence code. Get it?
I forgot about 29 minutes.
That's not a bad first thing to do. Like, I actually was like, oh, okay. I'm okay with that being the pro. Then it's like, so we're going to do this the whole movie. We're just going to keep resetting.
You could write a book, fill an encyclopedia with like good actors who got like a breakthrough Oscar nomination and then took a bunch of money and started a shitty big budget movie. Like, it is a tradition unlike any other. I have no problem with her doing that. Like, fine, good, but like, let's settle down here now for the next, you know, you did your shitty movie. Now let's dig in and then get back to work.
Go see Late Fame. She starred in that with Willem Dafoe. That comes out this fall. I saw that.
All right.
Very good.
That was good.
Yeah. She's also in the morning show though, which comes out every week.
But she's been there for a while though. Kind of, you know, it's
Apple and Disney. You can get those checks. Like Kirk was
so much money though. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Yeah. The morning show. Every episode of the morning show costs $9 billion to make. We all didn't like this. 59 for me. Kirk 54. Ken Jack 65. Clemmer 54. Gooch 40. Those scores are all significantly lower. That I'll tell you what. They are lucky they got musicians who know how to make good music, because it is the only saving grace of this movie. Like, pulling it out of the real world, that is just. I think that's the biggest, the most egregious error was putting it into studio, not pulling it out, putting it into the real world and pulling it out of the grid and what's interesting.
This is gonna be a massive, like Smashing Machine was this weekend, a massive second week dive at the box office. Like, whoever wants to see this already seen it. Like, there's nobody's going to see this next weekend.
It was tracking at like in the mid 40s last week, and it did a 33.
Yeah,
like I think the bottom's falling out of this thing. Exactly.
It's making Sepsi 2 where nobody goes to sleep and you stay in the real world. Just stupid.
Yeah. Next up, that's Tron, Ares. Roofman. Roofman follows Jeffrey Manchester, a former Army Ranger turned burglar who robs McDonald's by cutting holes in their roofs. After escaping prison, he hides out for 6 months inside the Toys R Us, living undetected and building a new identity until romance and his past begin to catch up with him. It's 2 hours and 6 minutes long. The director also did Blue Valentine, Place Beyond the Pines, Sound of Metal. Wrote Sound of Metal, the story. Based on the real life and crimes of Jeffrey Manchester. It's based on a real story. I think they did change a couple things up, but for the most part, it's true story. Yep. Guy did live inside of Toys R Us, robbed some McDonald's.
Sounds adorable so far. I don't know.
Yeah. Channing Tatum, lead role. Kirsten Dunst. Ben Mendelsohn, not a big role. Lakeith Stanfield, not a big role. Juno Temple, not a big role. Also, I'm going to spoil something. The most random nipple slip in the history of movies I've ever seen.
Out of nowhere. It's like the old days. It's like, I thought Mr. Skin was going to pop in.
Did you make it?
Just lying in bed, taking the phone. I'm like, is there a fucking nipple here? Let's go.
I could not believe. I was like, I was baffled. Did the movie's ratings change because it's
I was in shock.
I don't think I actually, if you told me that they didn't know until the premiere, I believe you. Jimmy O Yang's in it for about 5 seconds. Uzuduba's in it as well. Same with Ben Mendelsohn. They're kind of connected. But it's a Channing Tatum movie for the most part. $3.25 million on debut. Obviously not a massive release. Doing pretty well rating-wise. Rotten Tomatoes, 85-84. Critics' audiences. IMDb, 7.2. Metacritic, 64. Letterboxd. It is at right now, I believe. I have that wrong.
I think it did 8 million for the weekend.
8 million, yeah. 3.25 was the first day. 8 yeah. million.
It was the first overall. Day? Okay. 8 million for weekend. Good correction. Yeah. Thank you. 3.5 Letterboxed. I must say 2.8, but that's what we got on Tron Ares. Ken Jack, I'll start off with you. Score for Roof Man.
I ended up on like a 71 on this. And I think partially because it feels like it's like Soderbergh drawn from memory in a way, especially specifically the concept of Logan Lucky. Because like when you watch Logan Lucky, it's to a T.
Yeah.
It's Channing Tatum as a Southern working man that needs to turn to crime to steal a little money to support his daughter. That is Logan Lucky.
Literally, spoiler alert. Okay, this is what, it's not a huge spoiler, but spoiler alert, I guess. Literally does the same thing he does in Logan Lucky to escape the prison. He builds something to put underneath the
yeah. Yep.
Was Logan Lucky partially based on Roof Man?
In Charlotte.
In North Carolina.
Yeah. It's North Carolina versus West Virginia. Yeah.
Very strange. Actually,
it was like just so, I mean, again, like you were just saying, like it might be one was derived from the other or whatever the real story, but like it did feel just so much like it was that movie drawn from memory and just not as good. And it had some heart and it had some funny lines, but I do think there was a few points in this movie where I'm like, you could cut a lot of this. There's a lot of these random little celeb cameos where I feel like we're wasting time here. This is over 2 hours long. This should be an hour and a half maximum. And I think you really could have knocked out a lot of these characters. Specifically, like, this is a tough stretch for Lakeith Stanfield, a guy who I thought was like a pretty talented actor. Like, think about this, between this and Play Dirty, like, he's picking like what should be interesting roles and just not getting shit to work with, which kind of sucks. But
looks checked out.
Yeah,
very checked out.
It's a shit role.
Very shitty role. And I like the concept. There is a little bit of charm at points that you get at everything Channing Tatum usually. But other than that, not totally into it. They prey on nostalgia a little bit. I never really got into it. But yeah, I don't know. Not hugely into it, but still you'll find worse movies of this genre.
Channing Tatum's character, Logan Lucky, was a former soldier too. He like
was no, his brother was a former soldier. I think he had like a football injury or something in Logan.
Oh, is that what it was?
Uh-oh. Yeah, Adam Driver had like the arm okay. off.
That's so strange. Kirk, score for Roof Man.
Well, let me say, I think this might be the most mismarketed movie in recent memory. If you watch the trailer, you think you are watching a lighthearted romantic comedy. And this movie is fucking dark. Like, I'm trying to figure out what to do with this movie, honestly. I don't think I liked it, but the movie reminds me of in a lot of ways is another Soderbergh movie, The Informant, which is my favorite Matt Damon performance, where Damon just plays a psychopath the entire time who's just lying, 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 and you know he's going to get busted. And like Channing Tatum's character in this movie, the director doesn't really let us, like, is he, they want us to think he's kind of a good guy, he's got a heart of gold, but in truth, he's kind of a monster. Like, you know, the real hero in the movie is the wife who's like, you're never fucking talking to my kid again. You're a piece of shit. And so this kid, this first daughter who he builds up this relationship with, she's fucking gone like 10 minutes in. We never see or hear from her again. And it becomes this movie where you're like, oh, this is kind of sweet. He's at Toys R Us. He's doing this. Oh, look how funny he is in his bike. He's washing his T-shirts. He's eating his M&Ms. But he's insane. And he basically like plays with the emotions of Kirsten Dunst and her kids to a point where like this guy is a gigantic piece of shit. And they start playing with that a little more where he's very needy. He brings all these gifts. You're like, oh, okay, this is an interesting play here. But then they kind of, well, he's kind of got a heart of gold. They don't know what to do with him. Like there's a scene at the end where she goes to visit him in prison. I'm like, this is gross. Like this is a bailout scene if I've ever seen one. I don't need this scene in this movie. I would have moved up if it wasn't for that. I don't know what this movie is. And like maybe this is actually a movie where years from now I may say I was dead wrong and it's sort of a darker, better film than I think it is, but it was just all over the place. I couldn't settle in with it. I don't know what it was, which isn't always a bad thing. But like it's just it cops out a lot. Like it cops out a lot, and it uses Channing Tatum's charm and his wit and his likability to kind of get away with it. So for me, it lands at like 70 because I do think there's interesting things in it, but it's not. There's a poster of like Channing Tatum's got like he's on like the little bike or something. He's got like something wacky on his head. Like, and like, this is not that movie. Even the scene that's in the trailer with Dinklage, the bomb, the pink,
the dye
explodes in his face. Yeah. In the trailer, that's played for a laugh. Mm-hmm. In the movie, it's like a pretty fucked up scene.
Oh yeah.
Honestly. Like, so it's, yeah, it's, I just don't know what it is. It was close to being good, I think, in a lot of ways, but it keeps kind of giving up on it. So I'll give it a 70 for some good stuff. And I do think Channing Tatum, still, you do like being with him. But yeah, I'll give it a 70.
Next up will be me, and I'm going to give it a 69. I'll keep my thoughts short and sweet and get into them after the rest of the scores. But basically everything said, echoed by me. I think tone was a huge problem here. And another story element that I didn't love, we'll get to in a second. But no, this was close to being something I really enjoyed, but just kind of missed the mark. Just kind of didn't, I don't know if it didn't know what it wanted to be, or if it maybe had a couple moments that distracted it from what it should have been. But I think it wasn't a full mess. It had a couple messy spots. Probably the best way to put it.
Before Clemmer gives his review, Gooch and Jeff and I guess, or Clemmer, like, did you think it was weird that like Kirsten Dunst, like he just rolls into that church meeting, like dressed like a bum, and they're trying to hook him up. Like it just, stuff like that just seemed weird to me. Like, why would they want to, like, what is that? What the fuck is that about?
I don't know the inner machinations of the Southern Church. Yeah, I don't know if it's just what they do or.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I don't know. Go ahead, Clemmer.
I like this movie. I give this an 81. And I think the heart of the movie, and something we haven't really talked about, is Kirsten Dunst's performance. I think it's fantastic. And she is really the point of the movie. And Kirk, you're absolutely right. Like, Channing Tatum is like this like charming guy. But I think that's kind of the whole point. Like, there's no way you can get away with this unless you are charming. And I think
that's a cop out, Clemmer. Like, you can do that if you're a writer or a director. You can make that happen, but like, it's still bullshit.
But we see who the real guy is. I'm going into the end of the movie.
When he puts a gun to a kid's head at the beginning of the movie, like a little girl's head, that's the real guy.
And also, at the end of the movie, though, at the Toys R Us.
Yeah, right.
When he punches the guy, and everyone kind of sees, like, oh no, this is not a good person. Like, and also when he blows up the like, he's doing like horrible things. And it's like, oh no, like this is a bad guy. Now, you make a good point, Kirk, about like how it does have that kind of coda at the end with in the prison.
Oh, I hate it.
I didn't love that either. But the rest of it, I kind of liked. I kind of liked how you saw the evil and the kind of the lie progressing and progressing and progressing until you realize it's going to be a tipping point. I enjoyed all that. I thought I liked the fact that it isn't your typical bad guy. And I kind of played with that a little bit. I give this an 81. I like this a lot.
Wow. It reminded me that prison scene I hate the end of Flight when Denzel's talking to his kid at the end, like he's like reformed, like bullshit like that. I hate shit like that. I hate it.
We'll have to edit this in, I think. Well, we don't have to do it this time. We can in the future. I had it ready to go and it didn't play when Clemmer gave his review, but I had the schmaltz alert. Schmaltz alert for Clemmer.
Nobody likes schmaltz.
Last scene, he was melting through the sea cushion.
He was crying. Clemmer's crying during that prison scene. Crying.
I think I do like schmaltz, but that's not why I like this movie. I almost feel like this is like the anti-schmaltz, where you have this non-traditional bad guy and doing more and more horrible things, kind of ruining and really hurting this family. It's almost like anti-schmaltz. So
I think if you ask the director, the writer, I don't think they would say he's a, like, I think they think he's a good guy.
I don't think so either.
That's a problem, I think. I think like a Soderbergh, I know what you're saying. I didn't get it.
I do think it's a little teethless. The prison sequences gets rid of that bite. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, we want you to be able to decide what you want. You take your own, like, they're playing both sides, you know?
Yes. It's, speaking to the marketing, we covered most everything, but, my sister goes to see about two movies a year with her husband when she doesn't bring her daughter. And she asked me if she should go see this because she saw Kirsten Dunst was going to be in it and she was looking for something fun. I'd just be like, no, fuck, stay away. Stay away. And this movie does a lot of things that I want out of movies for adults. Like, it is well acted. I do think it's well shot, well written, very reserved.
On film, yeah.
Presents like a very morally gray leading character, but if you're going to make a movie about a fucking convict hanging out in a goddamn Toys R Us and you're that unwilling to engage with the fun of that premise, I'm sorry. I'm going to sit there and I'm going to have a bad time. It wasn't terrible, but I just never at any point felt really engaged with the movie. I'm sorry. 60 out of 100 for me.
Clemmer, run me your score one more time. I was too busy looking for the schmaltz.
Clemmer gave it a 98. I
gave it 82, but you want it to be fun, Gooch? Like, it's a convict. Like, it's not going to be.
You said a lot of heart, Clemmer.
Fucking Toys R Us.
Yeah, but my issue with that, Clemmer, is I think they were trying. Like, I think they were trying to have
bike. He's doing this wacky stuff. Yeah.
No, there's some, like, he's in Spider-Man stuff. There's some of that for sure. Because that, but I don't think that if you're going with this movie looking for a rated R movie about a prison convict, I think you're kind of like going up. I think you're marching down the wrong path.
I think it was presented as a rated R movie for a prison convict. You thought it was presented as a rated R movie about a prison convict, a drama about a prison convict?
No, the movie poster says no. So to that, I say no. But
he's got the grabber getting the M&Ms. Like, I don't know. It's like, it's kind of.
Well, I guess what did you want in the movie, Gooch? Like, what you wanted kind of like a slapstick Channing Tatum's like falling more down.
To Jeff's point, more tonal clarity. Like, it is. It wants to be a drama while also reaping the rewards of being the John Hughes fun candy shop movie.
Even Dinklage, like being an asshole to that one employee, which is like the most forced. By the way, I was like, oh, I don't give a fuck about this guy. I don't care about this guy. Even like the Tony Revolori stuff in the beginning was kind of comedic. To me, it's like it's almost as if Logan Lucky had a scene flashing back to Adam Driver getting his arm blown off, like a dramatic like Saving Private Ryan scene. Like that's kind of like how this movie felt to me. Like totally, it's like mildly like.
You thought Dunst was like she's a good actress, but you thought
Jimmy O'Yang driving scene right. Like that's all like kind of
terrible.
Like, played so comedically.
Like Dunst, you thought was good. She's a good actress, but like there's not a pretty one note performance. I thought.
Oh, Clemmer. I disagree. I think it's a really hard role to play. You can't be too smart.
It's like the sort of like and like in love, like sort of middle class, like lower middle class. I've seen that a million times. Like she comes across like a fucking idiot. Honestly, like why is she with this guy? This guy's a nut.
Well, she can't be brilliant because she would have figured it out.
She has a PhD, they said at one point, didn't they, or something? Or like a master's or something?
I guess maybe like a common sense thing. But she doesn't play it stupid either, though.
No, she's a good actress. She's a good actress.
I think, like, pretty honestly, I liked the relationship she had with the kids. I thought she was really good here. I saw you laughing, Jeff. You didn't think she was good here?
Well, no, you now have the very, very unfortunate distinction of calling the Sean Penn performance, like, not that great. And so I'm always going to think of that. That's always my comparison. No, I think she was fine in this. I don't think it's her fault. I don't think it's Channing Tatum's fault either. I think tonally speaking, and the shame about saying this is too, this is not like we're saying this for like Tron Ares, right? Where it's like, if the tone of Tron Ares been different, it would have, like, it still would have sucked. Like, I do think if this had been clear on one side of the fence, like, this is pretty good. It's a fascinating story. Like, it's very interesting. It's like, so, like, what a bizarre, like, thing to have to like live in a fucking Toys R Us. And also, I mean, it comes out at a time like you know, they put that Blockbuster shot in there just to get a couple fucking nudges in the audience
and the old McDonald's logo.
Like I do think this fits exactly what people want. Like I would love, but again, it could not decide what it wanted to be, because for every goofy little funny moment, it had something that was like, damn, like on the phone is the wife with on the payphone. It's like, Jesus Christ.
You know what might have been interesting too is if they almost played this movie serious, but from Dunst's perspective, and like Channing Tatum comes to town and he's like the guy that just isn't coming into the, like inserting himself into their life. And then she gradually finds out that this guy's living in a fucking Toys R Us. That might be even more interesting. But I do think, like, again, just funny or more dramatic. I think the mix is a little rougher here, but I would agree with you, Clemmer. I thought that Dunst is really good. I think that's a tougher role that maybe everyone's giving her credit for, because that is like, that's a tough balance between like being like mopey dummy, you know, South Carolina idiot, and also like being like a real human being and playing real human beings. I feel like actors kind of suck at now, and I think that was a very real person that you would meet in real life.
I mean, yeah, it's just a wildly, the marketing for this movie versus the movie itself is crazy. I mean, this is like, this is a wacky, I read about it, of course, but you would have thought this is gonna be like a wacky comedy.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad. I guess maybe to lean to,
I agree with that. Yeah.
To the director, I don't know, did I say the name, Derek Cienfrance, who did Place Beyond the Pines, wrote Sound of Metal, Blue Valentine. So maybe like to the point of like what he's made, it would make sense that maybe this was supposed to come off more dramatic than comedic. But I do think it just popped in too much, or it's like, huh, which way am I supposed to to view this. So yeah, it's again, it's like I don't, if you were to tell someone to go see it, what do you call it? Do you call it a dramedy? It's strange. It's very bizarre.
I think if you look at it as like a study of like a psychopath, like I think you can say that for sure. Like I think that could, you know, like I said, I kept thinking of The Informant, you know, but as long as you go in thinking that's it, I think you're working. And Channing Tatum's an interesting actor. You know, it's good seeing him doing something. It's just good seeing him in an adult movie. So
I don't love that his daughter is essentially cast aside, because they do give you a pretty good couple of scenes that are very emotional. I'm like, damn.
Yeah.
You're like, that sucks. And then after that first phone call, and I guess technically speaking, she says his ex-wife says, don't ever fucking call again. Like, don't call here again. Like, but he does speak to her in the, you know, in the prison at the end of the movie.
Right.
So it's just like weird. They kind of just like, they fucking reel you in to care about him and his daughter. And then like they just replace her with two other daughters.
Also, he tells Kirsten Dunst that he has daughters, and she never once asked during that year of courtship, like, what's going on with your fucking kids?
Oh, he's just got three kids. He's got the twin boys. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I was thinking that too. She's like, well, tomorrow's like Christmas. Why aren't you with them? Like, this assignment you're on in North Carolina, like, you never go back to New York ever?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why do you always smell like hand soap from a bathroom?
Yeah, very odd.
That's strange. Anyone else stand out?
The Dinklage role was kind of strange, and I'm happy for him. I just want to say that. I think he deserved better than that.
Who's that?
Who's Ben Mendelsohn. I think he was having a good time, and I appreciate him getting
He was having fun.
You think it's a role he signed up for thinking to be a bigger role than what he got?
I think he thought it was a different movie than what
he might just. He might just be part of his like repertory with San Francisco.
Yeah.
A little more over the – not all over the map, but a little more around the map. 69 from me, 70 from Kirk, 71 from Ken Jack, 60 from Gooch, 82 from Clemmer. Clemmer liked it the most. The Schmaltz alert's going to be out.
He loved the Schmaltz. Yeah, he loved the Schmaltz.
I don't think – I will admit, big Schmaltz fan, this is not a reason for liking this movie. It's almost like the opposite of that.
When we were trying to make the social media banner – I asked the guys. I was going to do a different type of thing. Right now, it's like movies on like a Blockbuster shelf. But I was going to do like a thing of characters, our favorite characters. Kirk, you know, I think Rocky was thrown in there. Gooch, Ken Jack. We said like Darth Vader. Clemmer said Tom Hanks' character from Castaway.
Chuck Nolan.
And I said George Bailey, and I said Rocky Balboa.
Chuck Nolan.
That's fine. I like him.
But I will say,
didn't he, Clemmer?
What's that?
He had a toothache, didn't he?
He did.
He did.
I don't.
Crossroads. Don't you get it? It's a crossroads.
Yeah, I know. I got the ending of that. I sure did.
As much as we do disagree, though, not by a crazy amount. Like, I do. I actually do. I will say I do understand liking it, because I do think there's good stuff here. It's just like, it's like, damn. At least on our end, I think it's like, you know, could have been better. So that is Tron Ares and Roofman. Our main review next week, I believe, is going to be Black Bag 2, Black Phone 2.
Oh, Black Bag, I wish.
Black Bag 2, I'd be in for.
Yeah, well, I know.
I like Black Phone. Oh, that's good.
Would you be surprised if Soderbergh already had Black Bag 2 ready for us?
He shot on his phone, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Funny thing is, like, imagine, like, if you said, say, I wish Soderbergh did Roofman. It's like, yeah, it's called, it exists. Almost to a T. A Logan Lucky. Justin, quick score and 2-3 word review for Tron Ares and Roofman.
Tron Ares, I give a 50. And my review is cool if 1999.
Okay.
I like that.
Roofman, I give a 55. And my review is I miss Toys R Us.
Yeah, that makes complete. Yeah, that's blunt. Yep. Good. Justin, for those who don't know who Justin is, we're not going to tell you or explain. But just know that Justin not liking Tron Ares feels like that's proof they missed the mark.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, that feels like a movie for Justin.
Yep.
Honestly, for a lot of us in here, too. I'm not going to lie. This is just like, it's just woof. All right, next up.
What happens when you lock 18 coworkers in an office for 1 week to compete for $250,000 of cash? This is Surviving Barstool Season 5, presented by Rumble Premium. Each episode released 3 hours early, so get it ad-free before anyone else, only when you join Rumble Premium. Surviving Barstool premieres Sunday, August 9th at 5 p.m. on Rumble Premium and everywhere else at 8 p.m.
A little cinema time. Cinema and television today. We're going to talk a little briefly some TV stuff. There's some big TV things. But first up, we're going to talk really quickly, Clemmer and I, about a movie called After the Hunt from Luca Guadagnino, who's done Call Me By Your Name, did Challengers. He does a movie every 15 minutes, it feels like. There's a Luca Guadagnino movie out all the time. After the Hunt, a lot of Oscar buzz around this movie. And that buzz, folks, I assume is going to turn into nothing very quickly. This is out very limited, releases wider in the coming weeks. I don't think we're going to do a full review on this. This is a miserable fucking movie. I did not like this. This is like close to stinker territory. Quite shocking. A distinguished Yale professor, Alma, faces a moral and personal crisis when her colleague Hank is accused by a star student, forcing Alma to reconcile secrets from her past with the fallout of academic politics. Basically what they just said, there's a charge brought against someone. They kind of attempt to get to the bottom of it. He said, she said, basically. 2 hours and 20 minutes long. Julia Roberts, Ayo Edebiri, Andrew Garfield, Michael Stolberg, and Chloe Sevigny. Not out wide, like I just said. Bad reviews across the board. 3.1 Letterbox, Metacritic 50s, IMDb 6, Rotten Tomatoes 47%. I give it a 45 to 100. I think it's uncomfortable might not be the right word, but this is fucking bizarre. Just, I get what they were going for, what they're trying to say, and make it like a thriller about like this he said, she said plot line, but it did not work at all for me. And if this didn't have a great cast with good actors in it, this could have been like career bad miss for Luca Guadagnino. And I think it borders on that already.
Yeah, I agree entirely, Jeff. In fact, if you consider the talent of the cast involved, this is even worse somehow. I give this a 42. If you like seeing missed calls, if you like watching people miss calls on a cell phone, this is the movie for you. I've never seen more missed calls in a movie. It's insane. It tries to be a he said, she said thriller the first half, which is okay. It's like palatable. Like, all right. The second half becomes more of like social commentary on like kind of like what is sexual assault to some extent? How does it help or hurt your career? It gets very in the muddy waters without even ever really clearing it up. It doesn't have the courage to actually make a statement. It just says a bunch of shit. And at the end of the day, this movie's bad. This is a bad movie. Julia Roberts, I could see some weird, bizarre world where she gets a nomination, especially a Golden Globe. But I can't see anything else happening. Andrew Garfield's not bad in this, but this movie can't be saved.
Yeah, this was bad. This was bad. So yeah, this release is wider soon. If you're a Luca Guadagnino fan, he's made some incredible movies. He's probably, in terms of like working directors, one of the directors that I think has been disrespected the most at the Oscars as of recently. At least his movies have been. Challenger's score is one of like the bigger misses recently, I think, by the Oscars that many people agree on. Speaking of Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross. This was a miss by him. Luckily for someone like Luca Guadagnino, he kind of just makes movies and moves on to the next thing. So,
or you could just, you know, maybe make one every 3 years.
Maybe you don't rush something out like this. Next up, quick hit here.
I'm sorry, Jeff, I have to say this. So much of the movie is focused on people's hands, like it almost showing, oh, when they lie, they can't lie with their hands. That shows you the cleverness of this movie. This movie is so blatant, like knock you over the head with what they're trying to say. It's terrible. Sorry, I had to bring up the hands thing. It was so annoying.
We'll move on really quick. Does it look good? Like, at least
it's fine. I mean, he's not going to make a bad looking movie. I mean, he's you know, but it's nothing like, it's nothing impressive.
Okay.
This is a movie that was supposed to be carried by acting and story, and it doesn't have it's rough. It's rough. Good Boy. Here's a different movie. A loyal dog moves. We all saw this, by the way. A loyal dog moves to a rural family home with his owner, Todd, only to discover supernatural forces lurking in the shadows. As dark entities threaten his human companion, the brave pup must fight to protect the one he loves the most. I'll give a quick score and move it over to Kirk. I gave it a 70. I didn't think it was anything too amazing, but I was quite entertained by this movie. A very interesting, different movie. You want a movie from perspective of a dog.
From a dog's perspective?
Here it is. But I think that's, I don't think very easy to pull off, and pretty well done for what it was. Well, I was entertained by it.
What's the Kirk. Josh Gad one that I used to, my daughter loved when she was little? The one with Dennis Quaid in it? What the hell's that one? The dog keeps dying. A dog's life. What the hell's that? know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Oh my God.
My daughter loves. She was like, that's yeah. That, so that was
a dog's journey.
A dog's journey.
And then there's the A Dog's Purpose came out.
I saw it.
A Dog's Purpose, then A Dog's Journey.
That's there's right. Yeah, I saw both. Yeah. A Good Boy was fine. It was like 68. Like it was. I think it took him 3 years to make it. This guy. I think it's an interesting. Actually, the making of it's interesting. Probably more interesting than the movie. It was fine. Like it's your basic horror movie again. It's basically, and this is how horror movies often are, as a hook. This time it's a horror movie told from the perspective of the dog. For me, it worked. It was, what, like an hour 10? Is that 72 right?
72-minute runtime, I think.
Yeah, great.
Hour and 13 minutes.
If a movie's long and it's good, great. But if this movie, I don't think, need to be any longer. I was fine with it. Like, I don't think I'll ever think about it again. For what it was, though, I thought it served its purpose. Yeah, I give it a 68.
That's good to hear. And you brought up the making of the movie. You'll hear the interview with the director at the end of this and the dog and the star, Indy.
Oh, I saw the picture with Indy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, which, by the way, I don't, dog acting is like weird to praise, but the dog, I mean, and that has a lot to do with the director who's the owner of the dog. I mean, fantastic. I think it's very much like a gimmick horror, but I think they got as much juice out of that gimmick as they possibly could. I think they nailed it. Took 3 years to make. Very interesting. Like, his reference points basically was recreating scenes from The Shining with the dog before they even started shooting. Really good stuff. I think it's just like a really well-made, thought out. They set out to make this style of movie, and they kind of executed it about as well as you could have. 70 out of 100 for me.
Clemmer, would you say the dog was better than Sean Penn? Performances this year?
I would not. I didn't hate Sean Penn. I just thought it was a little broad.
Okay, just want to make sure. I mean, the dog you thought was not too broad.
No, the dog was very good.
Right. Very good performance by the
very
dog.
Very good performance of the dog. I like the dog a lot.
Yeah. There you go. What'd you give it, Clemmer? What'd you give it?
100.
I give it a 71. The dog being in distress made me upset.
Yes.
Yeah, it's tough.
That bothered me like a lot. Dogs are so vulnerable, and like seeing the dog, and so that made me upset. But I did a lot of the behind the scenes stuff during the credits. They kind of spoke, and that was like Kirk said, that might have been more interesting in the movie. But I like this. Nice short runtime, in and out. But if you're like super squeamish about dogs, this might not be the movie for you.
Hey, Gooch, is there like a document? Are they any kind of documentary with this? Actually, be pretty interesting if they had like a 30 minutes. I don't know.
He brought up possibly including some of their test footage from like early on when they were recreating those old horror scenes. I don't know how like the rights and stuff work with
but
it is something that he discussed. He wanted to include, and if they ever have a physical media release, to include with it.
What'd you give it, Gooch?
I gave it a 70 out of 100. I definitely have like some of those same complaints. I'm a huge dog person, so like, anytime seeing like a dog on screen, like stressed for 70 minutes, it is tough to sit through, but I do think it's very well made.
That's been a big question of people who haven't seen it, right, Ken Jack? People haven't seen it, been like if you've seen it, how stressed out am I going to be if I don't like seeing dogs? Because I feel like it is a little tougher to be like, it's just a movie, because it is crazy seeing a dog like go through things. You're like, you can't believe it's like, this is fake, I guess, but still.
Yeah. Biggest question I've gotten from anyone that knows I've seen it is, does the dog die? That's all I get from anybody. That's all I want to know. I landed on this with like a 78. I think that like when you consider the concept, like as far as going into production of it, like it's crazy. Like dogs acting outside of like dunking basketballs with wires and shit, like doesn't seem real, like Air Bud shit. But this dog is like a legitimately good actor. Like he hits his marks. He makes you feel what he's feeling. And I think the camera work from his point of view is really good. And I love how the movie keeps a lot of that scary shit in the periphery. Like you're just kind of seeing a shadow here out in the corner. You're seeing like something projected far away. You don't even see like the human beings' faces until like very like later on to the movie. I like how it was structured. I like the runtime. I thought as far as like horror movies go, they're all, we just talked about this, Tron Ares, so formulaic. And like, if you want to say like, hey, at least the structure of this one is formulaic, at least the medium isn't. Like, you don't get that anywhere else.
For sure.
So I think that this was unique presentation. I enjoyed the movie a lot, and I'm very impressed by the dog part of it. And the fact that this took like 3 years to make at like an Airbnb in Jersey or whatever with the director's dog is also very impressive to me. And I think that it was very unique, and I appreciate that a ton. So 78 for me.
Yeah, I think I'll see it. Like if you got a chance to go see any of the four movies we talked about today, I think it's probably between this and Roofman. This is probably the more interesting one, at least to me.
There are no horrors outside of this one in theaters right now.
I know. It sucks.
It's October.
Which is crazy considering we had so many to start the year.
Horror movies?
Yeah.
I saw one in the last week or two.
Did you see Bone Lake?
I've actually seen two. Bone Lake and Strangers Chapter 2, which is
That's true. Is that still playing?
Horrible.
Is that still playing even?
I gotta see that still too.
I'm not even sure it's still in the
It is. I gotta see it this week.
They improved on Strangers Chapter 1.
Don't have to see it, Clemmer. Don't have to see it.
I do.
For those who are unaware, Clemmer is seeing every major release this year. Every movie that's in theaters over 1,000 screens.
Well,
this
kind
year.
Of, yeah.
No, I am.
Well, except for re-releases.
Right. Correct.
Yeah.
Wait, did you see Nija? I forget.
Yes.
How was it? Did you like it?
I did. By the way, I was confident I had you.
It was well made. It was just not for me.
Yeah. Clemmer sitting in Gabby's dollhouse. I thought you didn't see K-pop Demon Hunters when it released in theaters, but you did. So I thought I got you, but didn't.
Wow, good for you, Clemmer.
Yeah.
Okay.
Really showed. Really showed.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. They did. By the way, speaking of Air Bud, they did announce a new Air Bud movie.
Yeah.
Is he in it? Is Indy starring?
I don't know. I don't know.
No, but the guy did say he watched pretty much all the Air Bud movies just to kind of get an idea of like how
you have to, right?
Direct a dog, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he said there's like a dog acting school in Beverly Hills, right?
Yep.
Jesus Christ. That's crazy.
Fucking insane.
All right, so yeah, those are the four movies, the main movies to talk about today. Tron Ares, Roofman, After the Hunt, Good Boy. And I guess I did just mention Strangers Chapter 2, really fucking bad. Quickly, this is not movies, it is TV, but close enough, we will mention it. Peacemaker had its season 2 finale, the sequel series to The Suicide Squad, and very heavily tied into Superman, the DCU James Gunn Superman, had its finale. I know at least Ken Jack watched it. Did not live up to the hype, it did not feel like, at least to me.
No, that was about as rough a landing, I think, as you could possibly ask for out of a DC series, or especially from a DC series where the first season was so good. Like that first season of Peacemaker, I thought was excellent. It's this perfect blend of like the humor and action that you want. And like I put it up there with like The Boys or Loki or any of the live action comic book series. And this was just, it was not the right thing. It was they did what Barry did, where Barry the first two seasons hey, we're comedy and we're giving you some drama that's really good. And then the last two seasons of Barry, all of a sudden they're like, oh, actually now we're a drama and we're going to give you some comedy. And this is what Peacemaker did, I felt, in this season. I did not like it. It was especially based off what they established in the first season. And I think they landed the plane very poorly here. And especially after James Gunn hyped it up this much, I really am super bummed, disappointed by it.
That is the one thing with Gunn. I like James Gunn, but James Gunn loves to discuss the secrets and the little things and this and that a lot. And it when it's good, it works. But when it's bad, man, it really gets people very hyped for something that doesn't have. I actually like this season more than Ken Jack did, but we landed on the same exact spot in the finale because I was pretty gravely let down by it. I was like, man, this did not hit the mark. And I liked a bunch of the season. So, yeah, Peacemaker was kind of a bummer at the end. Still some stuff worth it in the season.
Tomatoes rocks. Tomatoes is great and everything, but he was specifically very good in this.
Yeah,
great addition.
But there will be more of it. I'll say that. How about this news? Ocean's 14. As the biggest fan of Ocean's 11 in the world, myself, you would think I'm excited. I think this franchise needs to rest.
No.
Ocean's 8 was not very good. This is morbid, I guess. I don't know if it's morbid, but like a lot of people in the cast are not alive anymore. Like I don't think like bringing back the OGs, and they are apparently Clooney talked about it. Said that they're going to bring back Damon, Roberts, Pitt, though he was kind of weirdly non-committal. I wouldn't really call it Ocean's 14. Well, what is it?
No Soderbergh, right?
No Soderbergh, which is the number one biggest problem, hands down.
Who's directing
right?
It? Oh, I saw.
David Leitch is directing it, right?
Yeah,
I'm good. This is not needed.
All right, Jeff, you might have – you're the number one Ocean's fan. You might have insight into this. What is going on here where George Clooney is coming out and talking about Ocean's 14 getting off the ground And then the same day, maybe an hour later, Bradley Cooper is getting confirmed to be in this Ocean's prequel directed by Lee Isaac Chung.
This is not the
other one. What is going on? I know, but like, are they like in a big rights battle right now, or are they trying to revamp the entire franchise all at once? What's going on?
Again, the way Clooney talks about it, it's a little strange. He's not committing to saying it's Ocean's 14. It's like he's saying it's like we're bringing back most of the people from that, and we're going to do – because he said it's like going in style. So like, is he just doing a heist movie with a lot of that cast?
Oh,
but no, it's not Ocean's. Because Jay Roach is doing – who just did a movie in The Roses, which was
Jay Roach is directing the prequel?
He's directing the prequel.
Are you fucking kidding me? Jay Roach? I thought Edward Berger was directing that. No,
oh, is it?
It was definitely Jay Roach at first.
Attached at some point? Am I making that up?
Let's see.
You might be right, but I think at some point he was attached to it. Jay Roach directed her whatchamacallit in the Fox News movie, I guess.
It is Lee Isaac Chung
Bomb
now.
Show?
Yeah.
But it was.
So it's Lee Isaac Chung. Oh, okay. He did. He did take it over. Lee Isaac Chung took it over. Who recently did Twister took it over from Jay Roach. And did Minari.
Jay
Roach.
Yeah.
Of
Recount.
Game Change fame and Recount, the two HBO election movies, Sarah Palin movie and the 2000 election movie.
So it's not
other things as well.
So Clooney is saying it's not an Ocean the movie, or it is?
He's like, yeah, I wouldn't really call it Ocean's 14, but then he's like, it's like going in style. It's a very strange clip. I just like, if you all want to come back, great. Don't do another. Like, what are you gonna be like? Hey, well, this character's dead. This character's dead as well. It's like, we're really gonna do that. Also, in Ocean's 8, they did say Danny was dead, though I don't believe he was really dead. Remember, they cut Matt Damon's role out of that
because he had a weird
Me Too comment. Very strange.
That's right.
I got to be honest, the prequel intrigues me more than a sequel does. I find more intriguing.
Especially with Bradley Cooper being attached now, because he has not done one of those movie star typical roles in a while. Not since A Star Is Born, which he directed himself, but I would love to see him just dressed up to the nines. Gallivanting across Europe with Margot Robbie. That sounds awesome.
Dude, 60s in Europe?
We'll see.
He doesn't look dressed up in the new movie he's doing either. He looks kind of like a weirdo in the trailer.
When he directed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He looks like Marc Maron.
Yeah.
He does.
Stella Blue Coffee's new can lattes are here. Crafted with 100% Colombian coffee, each can is a good source of protein and comes in two smooth flavors, espresso cafe mocha and espresso sweet cream. And whether you're braving your morning commute or chasing your pup, Stella Blue cans are for those always on the go and for those who care. Stella Blue is more than just great coffee. It's about giving back. I named the brand after my rescue dog, Stella, who inspired our mission to help more dogs find their forever homes. Every purchase supports animal rescue organizations. So when you drink Stella Blue, you're not just fueling your day, you're saving a dog's life. Try the new cans today. Taste the difference and make a difference. All new Stella Blue coffee can lattes now available at stellabluecoffee.com or subscribe on Amazon for 10% off.
It's a trailer roundup. A couple trailers we can talk about, and we can keep this short. Did the new Game of Thrones spinoff do anything for anyone? Ken Jack, are you jazzed up for a Knight of the Seven Kingdoms?
It just seems like the trailer is like very tonally different from everything from the series, which is weird. And like when I was looking up like all the people that are involved in it, like I don't really know these people. They don't have a ton of work. It's like just a bunch of people that worked on Black Mirror making a spinoff of Game of Thrones. Like nothing about that is super intriguing to me. The book I haven't read. I read all the mainline Game of Thrones series, but I never got to this one. People say it's great. I don't know these actors. I don't know the directors. It's just like a big unknown. So maybe it's good, maybe it's bad. I don't know if I have hopes right now.
Trailer came out for Hamnet Kirk, which is the new movie from Chloe Zhao.
Yeah.
Big redemption movie after Eternals. Oof. Obviously, Nomadland was a success for her. Hamnet is right up there in terms of Oscars, odds, and predictions, but it's one of the few that remain that has not been seen by many or released by, seen by a wide audience, but it's up there for picture, up there for director, up there for acting. Trailer, did it do anything for you? Do you believe in its Oscar success in the pre-release?
It'll get a bunch of nominations. It actually felt to me like watching like, you know, PTA is a clear favorite. This felt like a Miramax, like, release in, like, 1996 against one of those movies. It just felt like that sort of schmaltzy, tug-at-your-heart, British, lovable movie. That doesn't do anything for me. The movie may be really good, but I was actually sort of bored during the trailer. I was like, what's going on with this kid? Like, why is this kid running around? Like, who, what? Another movie like Shakespeare? I don't. It felt like it was like made in 1996, buried and released like now, I thought.
Yeah, she's considered a front runner for director. The movie's considered a picture front runner. And Jesse Buckley's apparently like the odds on favor to win Best Actress. But again, it's like we don't have a lot to go off of.
Listen, we know Paul Mescal, good actor. Jesse Buckley, great actress.
Right.
Are we positive Chloe Zhao is a great director? Like Nomadland, obviously a Best Picture winner. She won Best Director. Weird fucking year.
Doesn't count. Weird. It's like Dustin Johnson's Masters. It doesn't count. I don't count.
No, yeah,
Best Picture.
And she follows it up with, in my opinion, really one of the worst Marvel movies to date. Like a terrible Marvel movie that no one wants to revisit. Like, I don't know. This could be like watching paint dry. Like
Kirk is still pretty emotional over that Hiroshima scene.
That's the worst scene maybe in film history. My mouth was open during that. I was in shock when that happened. Stunned. Clumber was crying, but I was, it was.
Waiting for that to end. That was a rough one.
For me, anything that hasn't been released that has Oscar buzz, I just don't believe until it hits. And I call that, what was it called? Damn, I'm fumbling the ball here. What was that called? The Steve Carell movie.
Welcome to Marwin. That's one of the greats of all time.
Another Zemeckis Marwin banger, syndrome, right? Where Carter? I don't believe it yet. And for those who don't want to call it Marwin syndrome, we'll probably call it downsizing syndrome because that's another one.
Yeah, there's always an Oscar bait that whiffs. You know, it's been his tail is all. I mean, these guys.
Yeah, seen it though. Hammett does have high ratings. I will say, but it's limited right now.
And these guys, I think, saw it. We haven't, but like, and we don't have to talk about it now. I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but there clearly now is like a co-favorite.
We'll talk about it now. Marty Supreme, Gooch, and Ken Jeksaw and had raver. You don't got to say much, but.
Yeah, I don't know how much we're allowed to say about it, but if you are a fan of the Uncut Gems good time flavor of Safdie's movies, you are going to very much love this. I'd say that's the barometer on whether or not you're going to enjoy this movie. If you like those two previous films, you will really enjoy this. It is a Timothée Chalamet show from front to back. Yeah, I don't want to go too far into it, but yeah.
Very Can I ask one time. Question without spoilers? And Jeff knows I'm going to ask. As a Shark Tank fan, is there a chance I'm going to get a Kevin O'Leary nomination?
Brother, let me tell you something.
Oh,
he is a fucking star. I'm not being ironic or funny at all. He is a star.
Let's go. All right.
People forget that there's a person in this movie that Clemmer competed with to get a job at Barstool Sports.
Also very good.
Who can forget?
That's right.
She was. She was in the movie, right?
Dude, I thought he had like one line based off the trailer or something. He's like has the sixth most lines in the movie.
He's begging for a job at Rough and Rowdy 2 years ago. Now he's going to get nominated. I know, Clemmer.
Nobody's saying he's not a nice guy.
We know he's a nice guy. No one's saying
he's a nice guy.
No one's saying he's fucking Larry Nassar.
I DM'd him after the trailer. I was like, holy shit, dude, congrats. And Ken Jack and I interviewed both Safdies years ago for Uncut Gems, and they said they just love seeing random New Yorkers and casting them. And he's like, they saw me in a New York Knicks celebration side talk video. And they DM me and they were that's it.
Dude, half the cast is basically that exact flavor of human being. I would say that. And to echo Gucci's point too, I think it's like an evolution, right, of like the New York City chaos movies where it's like Uncut Gems and Good Boy, whichever order you want to put them in. Like Marty Supreme is the final evolution. Like the formula was perfected, I think, versus those two. Maybe it gets
Question last week of which Safdie is the better Safdie.
There's a very interesting conversation to be had here about which one was at least trying to do something different versus which one and did better.
Do you think they flipped a coin, though? Who can make the chaos movie? They're like, all right, only one of us can do it at the same time.
And which one of them gets The Rock and which one of them gets Timothée Chalamet is also
gets Ronald Bronstein.
Which was huge.
I think that's the secret sauce right there. I think he's the one who has that kind of chaotic unnerving energy to him.
The script and score incredible, right?
Yeah, this is going to be a great campaign. Like Timothy Chalamet just coming
very
out.
Excited.
Like he's making it very fun.
This is going to be the last thing. I don't want to hang up on a thing that nobody's like literally no one's seen except for a few people. But I will say this has been a thing that I know Kirk and I have talked about a lot in the last year. Anyone who was a big fan of Chalamet, if he does win for this in original role instead of winning for last year for Dylan, that is such a win for everybody, I think. That is so much better. So much better.
Big time agree.
That'd be great. And then last trailer.
No, actually, do we have to talk about this fucking trailer for this thing?
Really quickly, Wonder Man, real quick. Can you get a quick Wonder Man
that's
explanation?
What I'm saying. Do we even need to talk about Wonder Man? This,
Can we get a quick, what is Wonder Man?
Yeah.
I mean, a Z-list character from the comics who has been reimagined a million times. His powers include invincibility and being as strong as the Hulk. Sure. And occasionally he's a bad guy. Sometimes he's a good guy. Basically, they just looked at their shelf and they're like, what's a character no one knows anything about? And we can just rewrite him completely and do this in-universe meta thing with him. And that's going to be Wonder Man. It's like weirdly like they're making a Marvel movie about like in the television. Yeah, it's dumb.
It's very meta though, right? Like the trailer talks about superhero fatigue. It's a very meta thing.
They do not have the writers at the Disney Plus headquarters to pull this thing off. They just don't. The writers that they had, they worked on Andor. Those guys are gone.
Yeah, that's
it. They watch a studio or something, and they thought they could be clever.
That's what it feels like.
Yeah,
it's been in production for about 5 years now. They announced this like with their original slate.
Yeah,
this was
terrible.
This was like initially this was one where I was kind of excited for it because it was so different from the rest of the slate. But now seeing like what they've done with every unique project that they've had. It's like, well, it just always ends up horseshoeing back to big time, big CGI villain fight by episodes 7 and 8. So I've lost all faith in what Disney Plus can do with those Marvel television shows, to be honest.
Last trailer, Mercy, with Chris Pratt and Rebecca Ferguson, from the director Timur Bekmambetov, I believe how you say it, did Search. He is the person who made the, it's called Screen Life. That genre where you are watching a movie, it's the screen and someone looking at the screen, or you're looking at somebody on a screen, did Searching, which is a really unique, good movie. And then for those who don't know, that's with John Cho, by the way. He also did the new War of the Worlds movie with Ice Cube. Yes.
I love it.
Which is... it's bizarre, not even a real movie. It's a shame that the show hadn't started in weed because that would have been a fantastic thing to talk about. It's so bad. In the near future, a detective stands on trial accused of murdering his wife. He has 90 minutes to prove his innocence in the advanced AI judge, to the advanced AI judge he once championed before it determines his fate. Rebecca Ferguson, Chris Pratt. The trailer, if you watch it online, is introduced by Chris Pratt. And he says, like, your mind's about to be blown. You're like, why? Why? This comes out in January. So, this looks bad.
Terrible, terrible.
It's getting a lot of play in trailers. Like, I feel like I've seen it like 5 times in the last week.
Chris Pratt is kind of bizarre. Why? I guess they have two big movie stars in it. So
I think also just that January dumping ground. I mean, Chris Pratt movie in January, like that's. I think that's the only reason why.
Yeah, it's just like let's make Minority Report very bad.
Yeah, and I was about to say it could be good. It looks like Minority Report meets a big pile of shit. Just kidding. Yeah. It looks like dog shit.
It's like
turd pile.
Is he like the Wes Anderson of this genre? Like he only makes this genre? He just does these screen movies?
It's not a bad idea. Like, it's not a bad idea because I do think there is a real problem with how we capture like technology, 21st century technology in movies today. There's like only a handful of directors who seem to be able to figure it out. This guy's not one of them, but one guy will eventually come along and figure out how to do this style of movie. He's not the one, but
Yeah, I'm kind of not interested in going on any more journeys with Chris Pratt either. I'm sort of all set. I think I've seen all the every play in his book. I don't know. Just do
Star-Lord. Just go fight.
Yeah, you know? Right. Just
keep it rolling. That seems to be no more. What's his? I feel like I ask Kenjack this question once every 2 months. What's his character's name in Jurassic Park? Jurassic World?
Oh, Owen.
Fuck.
Yeah, Owen. What?
Owen Grady.
Owen Grady, right? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Owen Grady.
What a memorable guy. Closing notes, closing thoughts. Diane Keaton passed away at 79.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace to Diane Keaton.
Giant. I mean, I will say, like, real quick, you know, not a lot of people starred. She starred in 3 Best Picture winners in a decade. You don't see that a lot. And she was nominated for Best Actress 4 decades in a row in different roles. And she was, I mean, you see her in interviews. You know, she's it's sort of the same person I'd seen a lot of her comedies, but you watch a movie like Godfather 2 or Reds, and it's just completely different than her. I mean, she's great in Shoot the Moon's another one. She was a great actress, and you could put her in Annie Hall, and you could put her in Godfather 2. So, you know, a giant. We've lost Hackman, Redford, and Diane Keaton already this year, and she's right up there with any actress of the last 50 years, I think, for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then anything else? Quick hits, quick movies? Anyone see anything worth
John
noting?
John Candy documentary is very good on Prawn. That was amazing. I was like fucking tearing up within the first 10 minutes. That was a really good documentary. I think Colin Hanks made it too.
Yeah, he did.
I
didn't know that. Yep. Oh. I saw it. It was good. And it's hard to make a good documentary about just like a really nice guy.
Yeah.
Like there's not a lot of, you know, he went through some inner turmoil, but they talked it. I think everybody pretty much was still alive. They talked to it. Super good nostalgia too. If you're a John Candy fan. Yeah, I really liked it.
Quickly before we move on to our list, I said I would talk about physical media releases that I get. I'm going to show a couple off here. I ended up getting the double dip. They got the new Back to the Future. They released new covers. Kind of looks cool. Steelbooks.
Nice. Nice.
Main reason I got these, because the ones I bought, I got like the set that kind of all aligned. It doesn't fucking work anymore. Speaking of James Gunn, Superman came in. Very excited to have Superman. Watch that again. I think all 5 of us enjoyed Superman, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fortress of Solitude on the front.
Yeah.
This one is special. The first ever physical movie. By the way, you got to be watching to really appreciate this. So make sure to subscribe and follow on YouTube. First ever movie that I've seen with Clemmer and Kirk together that I got a physical media. F1.
Oh, wow.
F1.
Drink some flat soda with that and some salty popcorn.
salty popcorn. Yeah. I dumped a bag of salt in my popcorn. This is I will say, there's shout out to Apple for releasing a physical copy.
Yeah,
of
true.
Yeah.
This is pretty low on grades for me. Like I typically have to be something nostalgic or really good, but it looked good enough where I'm like, you know what, having this is not a bad, like kind of turn your brain off watch. And then A24 does release some really nice, physical media. I got Eddington. I liked it too much, to not get it. I like the way they kind of have their movies. So those came in, add them to the shelf.
Do you keep
shout out to them?
Do you keep the A24s like, you know, in their own section?
Say it again.
Do you keep the A24s?
No, they stick with the criterion, like friendships up there. The Zone of Interest, which I'll never watch, but it was so good. I was like, I feel like
parties for that. You know, like a
have a commentary visit. Yeah. Did you hear that in the background? That was interesting.
Who's screaming back there? Yeah.
They do a good job. Shout out to that. But again, shout out to Apple for releasing a physical. Like that's
Look good for Apple too. That movie made I think like Clemmer $600 million worldwide. Like, you can do both, you know, you can do both.
Good on that small company, Apple, you know,
good for them. The plucky underdogs. Yeah.
You can make fun of that, but like fucking Netflix has more money than God.
Absolutely.
So is Amazon Prime and they make shit like Play Dirty. And I mean, just go to the Netflix catalog. Fuck them.
They, only 90 billion more to pay off Jennifer Aniston's contract for the morning show. One DVD at a time.
Stella Blue Coffee ready to drink can lattes are officially available nationwide at Target. That's right. Whether you're making a Target run for toothpaste, paper towels, or somehow spending $200 on things you didn't know you needed, stop by the coffee section and see why everyone is turning to Stella Blue. The cans are made with 100% Colombian coffee, real dairy, real sugar, and contain 190 milligrams of caffeine. They've got dessert-level flavor with coffee-level function. You can choose from espresso, sweet cream, or espresso cafe mocha. And once you try them, you'll understand why they're the best canned lattes out there. Here's the best part. 100% of proceeds will go toward our We Brew to Rescue mission. in which we're funding the adoption of 1,000 pets across the country. Grab a Stella Blue at Target, taste the difference, and make a difference. Stella Blue Coffee.
Before we get to our list here, top 10 best threequels, we have an interview with the director of Good Boy, the dog movie we just talked about, Ben Lienberg. Enjoy.
All right, we are very, very happy to welcome in, and we had for a minute Indy, this true star of the show here.
For sure.
But Ben Lienberg, who you directed Good Boy, a movie which I think made the rounds in a huge way over, especially when it first dropped. Because people love dogs, people love horror movies, and this combines the two in one of the most fascinating and like unique movies I think I can ever remember seeing.
Yeah, no. No, thank you. Yeah, no, I mean, I think everyone can relate to dogs so easily, and everyone's kind of familiar with the trope from horror movies or the real world of, that's weird, my dog is barking in the middle of the night for no reason or staring at nothing, and the movie just kind of takes that concept and runs with it.
So a loyal dog moves to a rural family home with an owner, only to discover that supernatural forces are lurking in the shadows. A dark entity threatens his human companion, so the brave pup must fight to protect the one that he loves the most. Again, Good Boy, just the first thing that I thought of after watching this was how many people have told you that you are crazy for trying this?
Yeah, I mean, they say don't work with kids and animals for a reason. There's a lot of reasons for that. It was not a normal shoot, to say the least. Look, it's a crazy way to make a movie. But again, I think the idea feels relatable. So people would say, that's a good idea, but it seems like impossible to make. The challenge is figuring out how to make it.
We just had Indy in here, which we'll include some footage inside the interview, and he was an absolute star. I mean, came in, dominated our office. I've seen a lot of dog performances over the year, and they can hit their marks, but there are very few, if any, that I've ever seen who are so emotive. Is there something you did in the training process, or is that just all within him?
So I love the way you put it, that like you can train a dog to hit marks or like do tricks. So much of Indy's performance isn't that. Indy's my dog. We got him to be our pet and friend. We didn't think he was going to be a movie star when we got him. I thought this film would be made with like a traditional dog actor, whatever that means. And I think what makes his performance so special is that we figured out a way to work with him that captured these things that feel really genuine. Part of that is because he's my dog and I stand in as the body of the lead human actor. You get moments of genuine love and affection because that's Indy's relationship to me. But then the other thing is that we kind of figured out a filmmaking process that centers and is built off something which you didn't get to see because he's very excited. But he in his house, which is we filmed in the house we lived in, he has moments where his kind of natural state is that he's very intense. He loves to have a job and he has this really intense, unblinking stare, which for a filmmaker you can use to kind of create a performance around him. To explain a little more what I mean, if you can imagine, there's scenes in the film, or remember, there's plenty of scenes in the film where he'll walk into a room, hear a sound or notice something that only he can see. And we get like a shot, reverse shot of him looking intently off camera. And then through a point of view shot, we see what he sees. And it's moments like that that people always ask, how did you get him to look scared? And the truth is, we didn't do anything. The filmmaking is telling you how to feel, and then you project that emotion onto
him. Okay.
So he is emotive, he's expressive, but he's also relatable. I think people have an easier time relating to animals in some cases than they do people.
Oh, yeah.
Animals are general. People are specific. It's just, it's kind of a superpower.
Yeah. I think it's kind of interesting, and this kind of the movie touches on a lot, how pets process their owners being sick or down in the dumps, depressed.
For sure.
Fascinating the way they look at it. Like, for example, a guy was sick kind of recently and like bedridden, and my cat was like, he freaked out. Like, he had no idea what's going on. And you try and think about it, at least to me, like their brains are the size of like a peanut. You know what I mean? Like, they don't process it the same way. And to think of it from Indy's point of view, like maybe that's how they process the depression or their owner being sick. Like this must be some supernatural like thing going after them. I love that idea. Was that like something you guys are really going for?
Oh, for sure. It's interesting. So I'm a filmmaker. My wife is a scientist. She's also the producer of the film and Indy's dog mom. And there's kind of an interesting like collision of our two worlds in the movie, because the main character's sister, even openly suggests that maybe what explains Indy's strange behavior isn't supernatural. Maybe what's happening is real. There are dogs who can be trained to detect strokes, heart disease, cancer. What would be so different from a dog's point of view of they're detecting an invisible dangerous force. Mm-hmm. That's a ghost. I'm describing a ghost. And yeah, they wouldn't understand the difference anyway. So we're taking artistic liberties and we're making a horror movie for sure. But there's an ambiguity in the story of, is this supernatural or is it very real? And this is just how a dog would experience it.
Yeah. I thought it was very interesting that you did. I don't know if this is going to be a spoiler or not. I believe this is in the trailer.
Just in case.
but we do not see the main character, the owner's face. I don't think at all, correct?
Mostly to like the last, like maybe
just
10, 10,
in the
minutes?
Last few moments.
Yes, yeah. Just in the last few moments. What was the decision-making process there?
So it's a marriage of a practical and a creative decision. So creatively, we wanted the story to be told exclusively through the point of view character of Indy, which there's a lot of reasons and challenges with that, that, you know, he can't tell a story through dialogue. It all has to be told through point of view and perspective. Practically, that means, I mean, you saw Indy. He's not a large dog. His eye line when he's standing is 19 inches off the ground.
It was one of those things where it's like actors are always shorter.
Yes. and actually, it really does surprise people. Most people think he's like,
bigger too. Yeah.
Everyone thinks he's going to be bigger, and especially if you see it on a big screen.
Yeah.
They're like, well, he's like a 50, 60, you know,
that's dog. What
he's
I was only thinking.
He's 35 pounds. But because, you know, he's small and the camera's on the ground, it kind of naturally crops people in the story, so you see them almost like Muppet babies, you know. And that also then opened up opportunities that, because I said, as I mentioned, I or my wife stand in as all of the human talent, and then actors add the voice, kind of the way James Earl Jones has the voice, Darth Vader. And to be very clear, they are the performers, we are not actors. It also has the benefit of, I'll say again, I am not an actor, having my face only in the film for critical specific moments. You know, works both creatively and practically.
Yeah, the ADR was good too. Not even just like the voice adding and all that, but the sniffs of the dog.
Yes,
like throughout it, every now and then everything would be like very, very like super silent. And I'm like, oh, for some reason that gives you like the chills a little bit. Yeah,
totally. I mean, the same way visually we wanted to anchor the film with Indy, you know, at his height, you know, and using his, you know, subjectivity, we wanted the sound to reflect that as well. So there's a lot of extra attention and care paid to his footsteps, the swoosh of his tail, the jingle of his collar. That was one of my favorite things.
Yeah, the collar. Yeah, the metal. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, it kind of lets you know where he is in the scene. I mean, you it makes intuitive sense and you don't think about it when you're watching the movie, but when it's not there, it's really noticeable. The sound team, it was a very small team that made this. It was just me and my wife filming all of Indy's footage, which was the bulk of production. And then the sound team was four people, five if you count the musicians, who recreated all of that from scratch, because what was recorded on set is us talking to Indy, giving him instructions, encouragement, you know, like telling him where treats are hidden in the room to get him to act. So every sound gets rebuilt in post, which, you know, happens frequently on big budget movies, but four people, two just doing the sound design, pulled it off and did like, it is a Herculean task.
So they're doing like the Foley stuff and after all this?
Oh, yeah. Crazy. So it's Foley, it's sound libraries, I think the key sound actually, excuse me, the jingle of his collar, someone's keys produce the right sound. There's the tricks in that stuff is just like fascinating.
I love the chains too. Like, especially that sequence with when he's like chained up. Like,
yes.
That
was, oh yeah.
Ooh,
yeah.
That got me. I think you did a really good job in this movie of keeping a lot of scary stuff in the periphery, which I think is fantastic in any horror movie. Cause I feel sort of like the second that you see what you're facing, you're less scared of it. So like the more that it's like, I think it's a guy who was produced Halloween said like the theater of the mind or whatever is way scarier.
Of course. Yeah.
So is that like a thought process? Like, we don't want to reveal what we're looking at until way later.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's just a natural progression in which you see this in horror movies, monster movies all the time that like you get a glimpse, a shadow moves, then you see a figure, then you finally see the killer at the very end.
Yeah.
That's kind of just kind of a normal snowball effect of how stories, you know, should escalate. But it's absolutely true that the imagination is like so much, what we can imagine is so much scarier than what we could ever convey on screen.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite quotes is, I forget who says it, but it's an observation about Jaws that like seeing Jaws at the end of the film is not scary. Seeing a shark fin is pretty scary.
Yep.
Seeing a ripple is terrifying.
Oh, it's true. Yeah.
It's just like the suggestion of what you can't see, knowing that there's danger, but you don't know where it is. That's so much scarier.
Yeah. It's almost like in like Alien or something. Like, the second you see the alien, it's like, okay, I can identify and see what I'm afraid of. But like when just hearing the rustling or the scariness, like music buildup.
I also you can't help but look for the zipper. You know, it's like that's a guy in a costume, and you know, and it's impressive. Like the alien is so cool.
Yeah.
But you're always just like, wow, they got a guy inside that thing.
Staying on the subject of scaredy cats and scaredy dogs, I think me and Kinjack both immediately clocked, and I think we're not the first to do this, that very similar to Courage the Cowardly Dog. I grew up on Cartoon Network. Yes. How do you feel about those comparisons going around online?
And it's so funny because of the films that and cartoons that were influencing me, I don't know if I'd ever consciously thought about Courage the Cowardly Dog, but I love that show. So it clearly made an impact, but like, I don't know. There, like that era of kids' entertainment, there were things like, you know, Are You Afraid of the Dark? Like,
yeah.
I really miss, you know, obviously there's a huge gap between like Scooby-Doo, which is not scary at all. Courage the Cowardly Dog, which was like oddly kind of disturbing. Scary.
Terrifying. Yeah. It was the animation was
so
too.
Gross. Yes. Yeah. And it was so specific. Yeah, I mean, I think it definitely made an impact. And I love that people are relating to it that way. I don't know. I feel like the interest in Courage the Cowardly Dog or the mentions of it alone, like somebody's got to reboot that thing.
It is kind of shocking that this many people remember it because it feels like it's faded into obscurity. Yeah. I mean, if I were you, I would take that over being like, this reminds me of Paw Patrol.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Or like
exactly.
Marley and Me or something. Like you want like something more specific that people can relate to. Yeah.
The one I've heard is so Courage the Cowardly Dog or Scarebud, which I wish I thought of that. But I mean, Airbud actually was pretty influential. Like that's, there's some pretty impressive dog performance and athleticism. But like,
we went down a rabbit hole on that director.
Oh my God, it's crazy.
About three weeks ago. He does nothing but dog movies.
Oh, he does dog movies.
So have you seen, there's a whole studio, I think when you go into Malibu, of like, it's like the Air Bud like academy.
Of dog actors?
Yeah, it's just like, this is what they do. I mean, the whole Air Bud canon is a really fun rabbit hole to go down.
What was his name? Because he looked like the funnest
guy. Oh, yes, and he looked like a golden retriever himself.
Yeah.
Which is like,
He's like this Canadian guy. He looks like the happiest guy in the entire planet. And I would need to find his name.
I genuinely mean, though, that like, I know Air Bud and Good Boy are very different movies. It's a very different kind of dog performance. But like, I did a lot of research into how dog movies have worked and how like, even like, where can you put a camera in relation to a dog? Just because their bodies are different than humans. And film equipment is meant for people, usually.
Mm-hmm.
There is really amazing stuff in there. Like, I think it's some of the later films where there's really complicated shots where there's like six golden retrievers playing the same dog, but it all appears as one continuous one take. It's kind of like, I mean, I guess that's what
they're doing, like a Texas switch with dogs.
That's it's like, I mean, I guess that's what Disney money gets you, but like, it's very impressive.
By the way, Robert Vince was the guy. He looks like he has the greatest life ever.
Yeah. Okay. I see exactly what you mean. Yes. That guy has Air Bud.
He's the absolute life. Sticking up some horror movies too. Obviously you and Carrie Fisher, your wife, independently produced this. Just kind of walk us through what that process is like. Cause we talk to a lot of people where they'll be like doing a Marvel or whatever. Mm-hmm. They have these big things, but like in this situation, how deep is like the exhale when you get picked up for distribution, especially for someone like Shudder, where it's like you go, wow, that's perfect.
Perfect marriage. I mean, it's one of those things where when we finally saw the cut and the Shudder logo is up there, I don't know if you've seen just the like the two scary notes, the Shudder logo is like, oh, that's exactly correct. That's what's been missing. I mean, it's awesome when it obviously gets picked up and is being distributed, and the reaction to the trailer meant that it got to go wide was just like, you know, incredible. For the majority of the filming, it was a very long shoot. You know, the most important resource, because we didn't have money, was time, which in some ways works out because we only worked with Indy. There weren't duplicate dogs. Mm-hmm. And the rate limiting step is his attention span, which is a few hours a day at most. Mm-hmm. So we were filming for 3 years over 400 days, at least. We actually lost count of the exact number, which is easy to do over 3 years. But we kind of worked on this the way that like some people restore cars, like in their driveway.
Like a hobby
It was like our hobby we were doing for the longest time. Our budget was what we had in our bank account. And like, you know, we had like an allowance that we dedicated to this of our time and energy. And I guess like we believed in the concept. It felt like that relatable core of why is my dog staring at nothing? And it's been amazing to see it kind of like, you know, find an audience.
What do you call it? I was talking to some people at the office about it earlier. I was like, dude, this dog is about to be like famous. Like, it's going to be crazy because not only like people obviously love dogs, like we were just talking about before, but I think the teen audience is so glued into horror. Like they'll go watch anytime a horror movie comes out.
Yeah.
It blows up, gets a huge like ROI, obviously all that stuff too. But like, the more I think about that marriage of like, young audience, dog. Like, I feel like this is going to be a humongous success.
Oh, absolutely.
I hope so. I mean, the other thing that's, I use the word relatability a lot. I mean, I genuinely believe that's what makes most horror movies at least scary, is that like it's, it helps that Indy isn't a famous person. He's easy to, even though he's a specific dog, it's easy to imagine that's my dog or my dog has done something similar to that. But in addition to like, you know, young people's attraction to horror films that you mentioned, I think it travels really well internationally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially the way we recorded the sound. It is just like so well suited for dubbing, which is something.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah.
I usually prefer to, just as an audience member myself, I usually like to hear, like, I do subtitles and like, mm-hmm. you know, to hear the natural performance. But it's a film that's really well suited to play in other languages. So I hope it takes off.
Yeah, I really didn't even think about that.
We gotta get this movie to, can it still go to Cannes next year? I want Indy to win more than anything. I want Indy to win the, are you aware of the Palm
Dog? The Palm Dog, yeah. Oh, yeah. We couldn't get him to Cannes this year. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, there's some version of, I'm pretty sure dogs can't win Oscars, but I haven't wordsmithed the Air Bud, you know, there ain't no rule a dog can't play basketball to get him into the awards race, but there's an angle there.
It's not about the fight and the dog. It's about the dog.
Yeah.
So you spoke about getting the distribution set up with Shudder and this being a 400-day shoot and, you know, shooting with just the money in your bank account. What advice would you give to other young filmmakers trying to go this route?
I mean, I think it's think about what resources you do have that you can use. I mean, mm-hmm. the chances are, no, you probably don't have, you know, your uncle probably isn't like a famous movie star who can yep. be in your movie and doesn't have $1 million that you can use to shoot your film with. But like, what things do you have? I mean, mm-hmm. for years I was making short films before I made Good Boy. On my family's, you know, the property of my family's landscaping business, which is like, you know, which meant there were a lot of films with like, you know, front end loaders and dump trucks, which yep. is like that specific and odd, but like, you know, it's an interesting, unique set. And it's a thing unique to me that I know a lot about. So yeah. like that was where I started. I grew up with dogs. We had this very, you know, trainable dog. I started to kind of kick the tires on like, would mm-hmm. this work? Could we do it? Mm-hmm. And we used time as a resource. You know, we didn't mm-hmm. have, you know, a large chunk of money to make this all at once, but we were able to just like find a way to chip away at it very slowly. So I think it's just figure out what, if you don't have the traditional way in, what do you have?
I love that. Yeah, it's kind of like an extension of the, what was Scorsese's quote from the Oscars a few years ago? Oh, make what's personal to you.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
Get a good one on that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a mentor of mine once said, make a movie only you could make. I'm not sure only I could have made this movie, but like maybe I'm the only person who would. Like, how do we treat, you know, filmmaking like long distance running and like, you know, mm-hmm. make it over this odyssey.
So what are some of your personal favorite horror movies? Like not even necessarily ones that inspired this, but just your personal favorites.
I mean, I think The Shining is one of the, that's not that profound of an answer. I mean, it's a very profound movie, but like there's a reason that film is so thought mm-hmm. about. It's mm-hmm. just, there's so many ways to look at it. Every time you watch it, you discover something new.
Mm-hmm. I had read that you had done some early test footage with Indy recreating some scenes from The Shining.
Will
those be on the physical release?
I'm not sure how to, that's a great question. I know there's a lot of talk about like, we have a lot of interesting extras just mm-hmm. because, I mean, there's all of the genuine production audio, which is also very entertaining. Yes, yeah. But yes, to figure out how to make the film from a dog's point of view, this was before a script really existed, like even in a basic form. I was just trying to figure out, horror movies are so powered by a character hears a strange noise and goes to investigate. On one hand, a dog is the perfect character for that because you can avoid the problem of most films where it's like, why would the babysitter go outside?
But
a dog would do that.
Yes.
You know, like a dog would just do that. But it was like, how do you film that? Because you can just tell a person, walk into a room, hit a mark, and look left.
Look here, yeah.
With a dog, it's significantly more complicated. You have to find a way to make the movie around them. Mm-hmm. And you also need to make it so the dog doesn't look like he's acting for treats. Mm-hmm. When we saw Indy here a little bit ago, he was very excited and happy. So that meant we had to, you know, one of the things we learned is we have to film in our own house. So mm-hmm. we transform our house into the haunted house you see in the film. But yes, to The Shining, we made a few recreations of scenes where Danny, it's the shot where the ball rolls up to Danny. Mm-hmm. He sees an empty hallway, but then notices the door to room 237 is open mm-hmm. and just mm-hmm. goes to investigate. And I made a shot for shot remake of that, just figuring out how do you put the camera next to a dog in the same way and get that similar performance. And again, it's like, you know, it's all told through perspective and storytelling, just like shot, reverse shot, objective, subjectivity, how those that all interplays together and creates a performance.
Was that shot from the kid's point of view? Kind of, is that like a low angle when they did like the blood coming out behind the
tricycle?
Yeah, it is kind of low, I guess.
So there's definitely not. Well, oh, so the one with the elevator.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's pretty low, I guess. I'm not dog angle, but yeah.
Yeah, you're right. So that is like basically on the floor. I mean, they certainly had shots, and that sequence is a great example of it where, I mean, it starts, we're like overhead Danny and he's playing with all his toys. And it's just like, this is a weird, unnatural angle. A ball rolls up and then we're like on his level behind him. So we like, you know, catapult from like strange objective shot to like shot of a character seen what the character sees and we're with them. That's all the kind of, you know, visual storytelling that we were trying to finesse out of Indy, who, again, can't say it enough, doesn't know he's in a movie.
Has no clue.
Speaking of Indy, will Indy ever act again? Like, is this something you want to continue with? Is there something else on your mind you want to make?
I mean, I have more. There is an idea for a sequel. I mean, making the movie for as long as we did, I worked with a co-writer. I mean, we probably have more than one film of ideas we couldn't put into this idea. So if people want a Good Boy 2, it's definitely possible. As to would Indy be in it or will Indy be in more things? It kind of depends. I mean, what makes his performance so unique and singular is the fact that we made it for the way we made it, which is to say, slowly, you know, he lived on set. He's our dog. We just filmed a few hours a day. That's pretty incompatible with making a movie with like a movie star. Like, you know, unless someone wants to be really cool and like move into my house while we make a movie around our dog, and they're okay with the idea of playing second fiddle to a dog. So, I don't know. Anything's possible. We'd like to say that he's very willing to sell out for the right, you know, the dog right food price. Commercial. For
he'll be in Saudi Arabia by the year's end.
He'll be doing for like, there's got to be like Purina or someone must be looking for like a Super Bowl commercial. You know, get the dog actor.
Exactly. If you could sit down and like pick the brain of a few horror directors out in the world right now, who would you want to pick it?
Oh, man. I think of like current folks. I mean, honestly, I'd love to talk to Ryan Coogler about Sinners.
Oh,
I mean, there's
God.
There's so many ideas in that. I mean, I feel like the questions, where would I begin or end?
Yeah.
And then, like, not going back in time, John Carpenter is, like, still so much around and, like, a huge influence on me. Especially, I've said the word point of view and perspective a lot. Mm-hmm. Not that he, you know, invented that, but, like, nobody does a point of view shot like John Carpenter.
Mm-hmm.
Even some of his dog acting. I'd love to talk to him about The Dog and the Thing.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah.
Which I feel like I've learned everything I can from that director's commentary.
Yeah. Oh, it's such a good one.
Really good one.
With Kurt Russell?
Yeah. Yes, totally. Well, and the dog at the beginning. So it's the dog that, I guess, spoilers for The Thing.
Yes.
The dog is the original thing. Yeah. So it's a dog who is masquerading as a dog and is a bad guy. And you get that as an audience? It's like, that is a feat that they pulled that off. It's like a dog who's like a secret agent. It's like a really impressive performance. And again, the dog didn't know he was in a movie. They just found a way to work with them and make the movie around him.
Kind of similar. I feel like the scale got bigger as he went on, but like kind of a similar experience. And like he would make all the music for his movies. He would produce it.
Oh my gosh.
He would shoot it. He would do like the whole shebang.
Yeah. I mean, Halloween, there's not a lot of similarities between Halloween and Good Boy, but we certainly thought about that film a lot just in terms of how it was made. You know, like there's a resourcefulness that I think works really well in horror films. And it ties back into, you know, the relatability. Having low budget meant that Halloween looks like it takes place in the real world. You seem like kids, you know, or like
real people.
It just seems like this could be happening to me.
Yep.
Which I think is like why that works so well. So we try to embrace that kind of like idea of, you know, there's a simplicity about things and that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Let's do Indy Escape from New York. I think that's the logical next step.
Yeah. Oh, you know, there actually is a dog movie that's animated called Plague Dogs.
Plague Dogs?
Have you seen this?
No.
Oh, it's old animation, so it's like very disturbing. Like, do you know like the original Watership Down?
Yeah.
Where like the rabbits like have like teeth and rip each other apart. It's like super scary.
Wait a sec. I think I've seen a clip from this.
So Plague
Dogs. I've definitely not seen it, but I've seen a clip.
Plague Dogs is not so different than Escape from New York. It's like an escape story about these dogs who are at it's like some sort of medical testing facility and then like escape. And then people are convinced that they're like infected with a virus and are like trying to hunt them down. It's just like, I'd see that movie. That's basically Kurt Russell's story. He's got the bomb or the virus injected into his neck.
Yeah. I saw a clip from
inexplicably twice.
I saw a clip from one recently. I think it was a Japanese movie though, where you've probably seen this, where it was like the cat having like the samurai duel almost with a dog. And like they would like they'd run at each other and jump and like he would like scratch him in midair. And it's from like the 80s or 90s too. So like,
whoa,
it was pretty
I
old
need
school.
To find this.
It was like old school practical effects. Like it was creepy, but yeah, those always get me.
We had spoken earlier about bringing Indy to Cannes next year. That may be off the table, but Academy Awards, they rolled out the red carpet last year for Messi, the dog, the performance in Anatomy of a Fall. Another great performance.
Mm-hmm.
Does the Academy need to do the same for Indy this year?
I mean, look, Indy would go for sure. He looks great in a bow tie.
I don't even think Messi dressed up. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, of course Indy would love to attend.
There we go.
I love that. We want to jump the campaign for that. Once this starts going wide, and right now you come out the third, right? It's the first.
Yep, we're out on Friday.
Yeah, so we're gonna start pushing the.
See this campaign in theaters if you can. Absolutely, if it's playing near you, and if you don't have Shudder, by the way, and you're a horror fan, what are you doing?
Oh yeah, I mean it's October 1st today. It is the perfect time. It's
very worth
it.
We saw it at IFC too. Absolutely loved it. Had a great time with that.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. So here's an interesting question, I think. So later today, we should be interviewing for a short time The Rock and Emily Blunt. I'm curious if you have a question that you would ask The Rock or Emily Blunt.
Oh, man, because the Smashing Machine opens the same day.
Yeah.
I mean, wow. You know, I've been very aware that, you know, the weekend we're opening against Emily Blunt and The Rock, two of the biggest movie stars, and Daniel Day-Lewis, like one of the greatest
Nemini,
actors.
Yeah, yeah.
And now Taylor Swift has a movie coming out at the same time, and we have a movie with a dog. Look, I think the thing I'm really excited to see about The Smashing Machine is that, like, it is, I love sports movies. I'm really excited to see that story. I'd love to hear about just, like, I've heard those fight scenes are like incredible and visceral, like kind of harkening back to the original Rocky movie. I guess I'd love to like learn about that. It doesn't really relate to my dog movie at all, but just as like a fan of sports movies, I would love to like hear about how that, how it was like filming that.
They were kind of brutal.
Yeah, we talked to Benny and that comes out sometime next week.
Yes,
most of the interview is very technical. Definitely check that out.
Yeah, fascinating. I got fascinating. Actually, again, like Gucci just said, make sure you check out this movie. Not even just if you're like a horror fan, dog fan. Like, it's one of the movies where I think you could go watch it on date. You can go watch it if you're a fan of this. It's again, your perfect time, October, Halloween. You got perfect era. It's awesome, super scary. The dread that builds throughout it. Again, the Periphery thing. I love just seeing. I don't know how you did that shadow. That specific shot, was that CG or was that just a practical push-up?
No, it was practical. So there's a few times we added it in post. Most of the time, so a funny story about the shadow, it's either me or my wife wearing like a cat suit.
Okay.
Catwoman, like almost like just like it's a tight, like, you know, Green Man?
Yeah.
So it's basically Green Man, but the material is black.
Yeah.
And if you light the scene correctly, you can just hide in the shadow and move a little bit. And it just looks like that shadow just moved.
Dude.
But the advantage of that is that we sometimes were filming it so the audience would notice.
Yeah.
But then we would also, because Indy required so much encouragement and like direction from us on set, there's dozens of shots throughout the film where the shadow is there. You're not really meant to see it, but if you look really hard, you can find it. And the reason it's there is because it's my wife like hiding behind the coats, being like, stay, whoa, load up. And we're trying to get you to do something. And if you notice, all it looks like is this creepy stoic, you know, human outline shadow. A little Easter egg to look for.
When it comes out on digital, I'll go and like boost the contrast and like try to search around for it. Yeah, the one in the car got me good. That one.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Like, and that center like shot pushed all the way in the back. Ooh, that one got me too. A lot of cool shots. There's an opening one of the house where it's like a really cool, I don't know if it was a push or a pull, but I remember looking at it being like, that's really cool.
Oh, neat. Was it the day exterior?
It was the day looking at it, yeah.
So what was neat, one advantage of filming for 3 years is that you can wait for the perfect weather.
Yeah.
All the rain you see in the movie, those are rain machines I got to build myself, which I absolutely, it's like adult connects. It's the most fun thing in the world. But for the days we wanted to, you know, horror movie feels like you're in some kind of like ghostly limbo. Mm-hmm. We could just wait for days of periods of intense fog over that 3 years. So all those day exteriors wandering through like, you know, the house, the graveyard, the exterior to the house, the grounds, the woods, the graveyard, you know, those are years of, you know, days stitched together. Fortunately, we have a dog who requires no hair and makeup and doesn't age. So that works.
It worked perfectly. Again, go check this out. Awesome movie. October, if you're listening, this came out on Friday. You probably already watched it. But yeah, make sure to check it out. Thank you so much for joining us. And let's go hang out with Indy more.
Yeah.
Here we go. Top 10 of the week is going to be top 10 best threequels. not the replies weren't terrible last week, but these are going to become nightmare fuel for those who don't like bad mentions, because again, we are all putting our name on these lists. These are combined list, top 10 best threequels. So third movie in a franchise gets a little muddied. Like, this doesn't mean, like, so you could pick, in theory, you could pick Return of the Jedi, you could pick Revenge of the Sith and Rise of Skywalker. You're a psychopath if you do that, even as a big Star Wars fan. But we're going to make it where it's like the third movie in a series of movies. So like if you wanted an MCU movie, you could pick like Iron Man 3. It wouldn't have to be like the third MCU movie. You could pick the third Hobbit movie, which if you do that, it's kind of crazy. Ken Jack is up first. Ken Jack has number one. So, Ken Jack, what is our number? And this is going to be interesting because I do think there's going to be a very big dividing line on one movie. Number one threequel of all time. Third movie in a series.
So, I guess like the kind of question is, do I want to cook you and take Back to the Future Part 3 now? Or do I want to save it for you later?
Who knows if I even take it? I think there's a consensus among you and me and maybe Gooch that is definitely not on the other two I didn't mention.
So I think that when I'm thinking of the best third movie in an installment, I'm trying to think of ones where not only is it like exceptional among other threequels, but it's also like the best among its own trilogy. And I think that there is one that stands out the most among all of those. It is Clemmer's already gearing his ass up for it. 11 Oscar fucking wins or nominate. Oh, wins. Yeah, dude. Lord of the Rings, Return of the King. It's got to be
Lord
jump of the
Rings, on the bed
Return
together at the end.
You made it
and they're all like, oh boy, oh boy.
That was
a huge hit. What do I know? It's
a movie I still love to this day. Like I whenever go and rewatch that, it's crazy what they were able to do with not only special effects, but like, dude, just going and filming in a beautiful location like New Zealand and just getting incredible cool practical sets and doing miniatures and doing real armor that they had these guys at Weta and these in like blacksmiths putting together this fake chainmail and shit. It just looks beautiful, acted great, and it's just like an awesome conclusion to an incredible trilogy. And I think it's the best of the three. I know Gooch doesn't agree with that, but I think it's very tough to find one that's critically as successful, to find one that's commercially as successful, to find one that is as good as a threequel bounced up against the other threequels, and also good again amongst its own trilogy. So I'd go with Return of the King.
Obviously, be my number one as well. It's a top five all time for me. It's 100 out of 100. So Return of the King. Also a great example of how to then not cut corners and try to do it differently years later and fail miserably when they did The Hobbit. Because it is fascinating how much better that looks since when they came out years later. Clemmer, you're number two. What is the second best threequel on our list?
I'm going to go with a movie I actually like more than the original, and that's Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yep, absolutely right.
I Raiders is great, but the Sean Connery element, and I just think they had it. It's just so masterfully done from the beginning. The River Phoenix stuff is great, and then just the comedic stuff with the Sean Connery, just him being there, to just a fantastic, exciting movie that I was just as excited. I saw it in the theaters '89, and I rewatched it a few months ago and still love it. Like it holds up. It's fantastic. Indiana Jones is great, and then that's the best indie movie. Period.
Yep, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a long time. I think Kendrick's like the number one flag carrier for that with The Last Crusade, I feel like. Dude,
has there ever been like two manlier men in a movie together? Like Connery and
great
and,
casting.
Oh, honestly, the
River Phoenix part's great too at the beginning.
Yeah, the Nazi was great. The like all of it, man. It's so good. Such a great movie. Reese Meyer's great. Oh,
maybe I love the only actor you could cast to make you believe that is Harrison Ford's father.
Yeah.
Very difficult. And it has like the authority to like boss him around and like call him Junior. Like it works.
You could have maybe done Eastwood, but I don't think Eastwood's an intellectual like that is quite believable in like the late. I don't think Clemmer.
Yeah, you're probably right. Also, like just maybe body type by that point, by 89 too.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, he just done the rookie with Charlie Sheen, but I don't know. I don't know. Connery, it just works.
It's great. It's great. It's great casting.
So I have a question for the next one because I have the next pick.
Iron Man 3 does count, yes.
Right. What do we do with the Dollars trilogy? Because of the way they're released, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is the third.
That's the third one.
It's the third.
Yeah. That's what
you have to do. Okay, definitely.
Definitely.
Yeah, so there has to, it's like, you know, is it? So then yeah, the good, the bad, and the ugly. The Dollars trilogy is obviously fucking amazing. I mean, it's like one of the most perfect trilogies of all time. I have something related to this in a moment, which I'm going to bring up. Hopefully, when I forget my next pick. But I think this is a slam dunk. All three are great. It is my favorite of the three: the good, the bad, and the ugly. But I don't think you can go wrong with any of these. Speaking of Clint Eastwood, that's a very good transition there to throw that one out there. I mean, you want to talk about fucking movie music?
No.
Oh,
might be the best score.
Ennio Morricone
might be.
Certainly, until 1970, it's the best score. Like, you know. The revolution in the 70s, but like, yeah, incredible.
Speaking of docs, there's a great doc out there on Ennio Morricone on Prime, I think, and it's fantastic. Just runs through all the scores he did throughout his career. Maestro. I'm up.
Yep, you're going up next, number four.
I was giving you a little guff for some Marvel action, but I think I'm going to dip into that. Well, I'm going Logan from the Wolverine franchise. Yeah, which I think is honestly
talk about going from bad to good.
Yeah,
seriously.
Neo-Western kind of hits like all the marks you'd want to hit. Like with a, how do I put this? It can stand on its own without the comic book stuff, is what I should say. The comic book stuff almost takes a backseat to the dramatic Hugh Jackman performance, the dramatic Patrick Stewart performance, and I think it's just brilliant all around. I can go back to it at any point. I'm always kind of shocked at really just how well made it is.
A movie that would probably have gotten more Oscar love had it come out 3 or 4 years later, I think. Right? Like, I think it was just like a hair too soon for it to get the Oscar love it probably should have gotten. And it still didn't. It got a fucking script nomination, which is crazy. It's a comic movie. Also bought James Mangold unbelievable amounts of leash and goodwill.
Yeah.
I mean... we'll see what he does after a complete unknown, but I mean, it's all kind of gone. Unless someone on here like a closet Ford versus Ferrari fan.
I like it.
It's kind of okay. It's sort of blah.
Forgotten. Yeah. I feel like easily forgettable. Logan's a great pick though. What a fucking elite movie. Kirk, you back to back picks, five back and six.
Okay. I got a couple of contenders. So I'll go number five. I'm going to go Before Midnight. The third film in the, which is essentially a horror movie. I mean, really, like it's just a tale of destruction. Like it's a reality. Like this is what happens when the magic is over and it's just two people who fucking hate each other.
Going to Chicago. Chicago.
just a great, great completion of, maybe they'll make another one. I hope they do. I don't know. Linklater always says it's the least successful trilogy of all time at the box office. but it's great. They're both great. It looks good. Setting is good. Yeah, and if you haven't seen those three movies, you definitely should. And it can.
Speaking of physical media, if you're ever going to start like getting Criterion, that box set's like,
yeah,
that's a great starter. Just a great Linklater, like recent, but like kind of spans a couple different decades of movie making. Like it's just, yeah, it's Linklater.
I still haven't seen those movies.
You haven't?
What? Isn't that crazy? I know. I just
You got it, Clever. I mean, I know you're going to see that movie, like Jeff said, where. Yeah. Kristen Wiig's talking to a doll or something. Like,
you got to go.
Watch these movies. They're great. Okay. All three, I think, are fantastic.
Yeah.
I'll get the Criterion, too, because that's a must.
So. Mm-hmm. You're a West Wing guy, right, Clemmer? You like a walk and talk? The first one is just a walk and talk.
Yep.
The whole movie.
I actually think it's a rare trilogy where the first movie's really good, the second one's better, and the third one's better. I think, in my opinion.
I love Ethan Hawke, and Julie Delpy's good, so I'm excited.
Okay, good. Tough call here. Do I go with a horror double pack here? Or would I really go with my heart here? And my heart tells me I have to go with the movie I've watched more than any movie in my life, Rocky III, Sylvester Stallone, Apollo Creed, Clubber Lang. I saw it as an 8-year-old for the first time. It changed my life. Is it a perfect film? No. Is it everything you want from a satisfying sports third movie? Yes, yes, yes. Is it Rocky III? Has to be. I mean, it's just an immensely satisfying experience still to this day.
I love that.
It's the Rocky movies have this very rare thing that I don't know why. I mean, I know why. You have magic in there with people who, you know, we don't have stars like that these days. But it's like, why don't franchises try to kind of hone in on like what is, like, you kind of strip aside, like, yeah, is it perfect? Is it as good as the first one? No. But, like, it's just so successful at capturing what everyone who likes that franchise enjoys, right? And that's kind of the case with, for the most part, almost all of them.
Yeah.
Well, it takes a moment.
What Stallone did, like, look, this is a super glossy, and of course it is, but you really love Apollo Creed after the first two movies. Rocky gets a shit kicked out of him. Mickey dies, and Rocky needs Apollo to bring him back. And, like, those 20 minutes where he loses the Eye of the Tiger and gets it back is just a fucking blast. And and the ending is really satisfying. Mr. T is a lot of fun. It's a great, dumb movie. It's as good as it gets in that genre.
You make a great point, Jeff, about how, like, why don't they just make what everybody wants in these movies? And they don't do that with 5, and it's so glaring.
Mm. Oh, it's terrible.
But it's also a combination too of, like, it's like you have a character, you lose a character, like, you, it's the right amount of, like, trusting the fans to, like, accept something, because I know not always, you shouldn't always give everything people want, because then sometimes you fuck up. Rise of Skywalker, great example, by the way. But, like, do enough that you trust them, like, hey, this is something different, a little new, but also still, like, kind of tugging on what works. And that does happen these days still. Some sequel, like, that absolutely happens sometimes with legacy sequels and old stuff too. But it is a good example, because again, it's like, how often you see a movie where someone who's a fan of the franchise, like, you know, like you, Kirk, say, like, hey, is it perfect? No.
No.
If I were to do, like, greatest in terms of, like, you know, if I were to go nuts and bolts, but, like, it still satisfies everything. That, to these days, with franchise stuff, that's just rare. It just doesn't happen. So Before Midnight and Rocky 3, Gooch, you have 7.
I'm going to go with a movie. I don't know. I think, Jeff, you've seen it, and I think, Kirk, you have this logged as well. Three Colors Red, the Three Colors trilogy, Touch. Christoph Kieslowski. That trilogy, it's, like, hard to recommend to people because it's very – I mean, it couldn't be more fucking French. Like, it's literally a trilogy about the colors on the French flag, blue, white, and then capping it off with red. But I'll tell you what, red is fantastic. Yes, another great box set to have. And caps off in a way that's like the Infinity War. They have a portal scene basically for French people in that trilogy. It's fantastic. Very touching, very moving. I will recommend that to anyone who's, like, looking to get into more, like, European films. It's really, really great stuff. Is that Juliet? No, not Juliet Binoche is the first one.
Correct.
I
think he was nominated for director for that. Which
Irene Jacob.
Which was unusual for 95. I mean, that was And I think screenplay too.
Yeah,
saw very the theater, good. Which was an experience.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. What's how old? Yeah.
That was that I first saw this during my, like, run of, like, COVID, like, kind of seeing every old thing that I've ever had on a list that I hadn't seen. Excellent. Again, another box that I can shut off Criterion. My pick, number 8. We have 3 left. I'm going with an elite third movie that nails every part of that movie. And that's Toy Story 3. A great third movie in a trilogy that just fucking knew the assignment and crushed it. Knew exactly what to do to grab both. It's the perfect Pixar element of, like, pretty deep for what it is, picking, you know, a way to connect with young people, with older people, kids who grew up with it, all that and more. I think the fourth movie, is really solid, but it's a bummer that they kept going after the third. And I mentioned before with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, there's a amazing For All the Wrong Reasons interview with Bill Maher and Quentin Tarantino.
Bill Maher, isn't this?
Just doesn't let Quentin Tarantino cook at all. And at one point, he talks about trilogies, and Tarantino says the only perfect trilogy is the Dollar Trilogy. But he said, like, Toy Story 3 is the best ending to a trilogy ever. And he said, I'll never watch the fourth movie. He's like, why would I? Like, they ended perfectly. And Bill Maher, fucking asshole, goes, Toy Story, is that a cartoon? Is that animated? Is that cartoon? What a douchebag. Is that a cartoon? Way to flex more I don't know. I'm too cool for that. I don't know what that is.
Dude, as somebody who watches a lot of animated stuff, calling animated stuff cartoons is like a slur.
Is that a cartoon?
They were like your dad. Dickhead.
Yes, it's the dad effect where it's like my dad would say that.
Right.
If you want to exit that, there is one really good part of the interview where it's Bill Maher being an ass that makes it good. Is he tries to really talk up 1917 and how it's all one take, and it drives Tarantino up a fucking wall.
Oh, same year, right?
Yeah, he's like, yeah. That's bullshit. He's like, I think it was the best movie of the year. He goes, no, it wasn't. He goes, my movie was. And then he goes off on the answer. That's worth watching just for that. Clemmer, so I have Toy Story 3. Clemmer, number 9.
I'm really torn here. I'm going to go with National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation.
Ooh.
I think this is one of the funniest movies of that decade. It's better than European Vacation. Definitely. I still watch it every year and laugh. It holds up really well.
It does.
And it's one of Chevy Chase. It might be his last. Like,
oh, that's his last.
Dirty work for like.
Yeah, that's his last hit though. Where he's like, yeah, for sure.
And the last time he's funny
for sure.
Other than I guess Community, but it's a different kind of funny. But Christmas Vacation, I think, is fantastic. And it hits everything you want from a vacation movie. I love it, and I still watch it every year.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even consider that as like a third, but it obviously is. But like that is that's a great one. Pick.
I don't think I would have thought that. To me, it is. It's one of my favorites. There's so many little. My dad's favorite thing in that movie will always be Cousin Eddie with the dickie underneath his see-through white turtleneck. That is, yeah. The 911 call being like a man in a leisure suit came to kidnap my husband. That's a great pick. Number 10, there's a lot left, Ken Jack. What's number 10 on the list?
I'm kind of caught between a few where like there's one on here where I'm like, wow, this is way better than the other ones in the trilogy. And then there's other ones where there's movies that are after it, which are a lot better than it. And it's kind of tough, but I think what I'm landing on is because it has the most out of all of these, the biggest powerhouse performance within it. I'm going to go with Mission Impossible 3. I like Philip Seymour Hoffman in Mission Impossible 3, I think is exceptional and so much better than anything I can get. Not to, I guess, do honorable mentions later and stuff, but like so much better than anything in like Revenge of the Sith or like John Wick 3 or Captain America Civil War. Like Mission Impossible 3 has the powerhouse performance from him and has an incredible stuff, obviously amazing stuff from Tom Cruise. I think the actual action of it is shot so differently, which is what I loved about what they did in the early Mission Impossible, where like they would just give you a different director every time and give you a totally different presentation, where it didn't totally work in 2. It did work here with JJ. So I still really, really like Mission Impossible 3. And I think people are coming around to it now more days. And man, dude, Philip Seymour Hoffman is just unreal, as was Damien. What was his last name? I forget. But just a great, great villain. One of my favorites ever.
Yeah, it's one of – I don't love Mission Impossible 3, but it's – like I'm never a huge fan of it, and I love the franchise. But if you were to have me do a list of like Philip Seymour Hoffman things, like it is such a menacing, just nasty villain in such a toned-down way. Also, just watched Punch Drunk Love the other day too, which is just he's fantastic.
God, he's so good, dude. He's so good.
Yeah, when he comes and confronts him. There was one franchise which actually I think had two picks that didn't get thrown in here, and that was Bond. I think you could have picked Goldfinger. You could have picked Skyfall too. Mm-hmm. I think Bond is probably up there.
I didn't think about Skyfall.
One of them is on the fan list.
What's the fan list? Let's hear it.
All right, you guys ready for this? Number 10, Return of the Jedi. Number 9, Goldfinger. Number 8, Before Midnight. Number 7, Toy Story 3. Number 6, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. Number 5, Three Colors Red. Number 4, Logan. Number 3, Infinity War, which I don't know if we're counting that. Number 2,
That is the third Avengers movie. If we're doing that by the – it's tough with that because like Avengers is such a buildup of other things too. It's weird.
It is very weird. And then number 2, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Number 1, Return of the King, which is kind of like going away. Return of the King is like way up there.
Yeah, it's what I figured would be.
All right, don't go any further. It's Gooch. Proud of you for making it this far, so I'm going to tell you how to be a part of our fan rankings. All it is a follow from us on Letterboxd. But before we get to that point, I want you to comment below, whether you're listening on Spotify or watching on YouTube, comment below with the best movie that was released the year you turned 3. So the year you turned 3, what was the best movie released that year? Comment that below with your Letterboxd username, and I'll follow you back. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. It's a good last pick.
Yeah, the other one I considered was Army of Darkness, which is the I was pairing the horror movies Before Midnight and that I considered. So yeah, Return of the Jedi to me just doesn't. I like everybody else. Ewok stuff is so stupid. I just can't.
And I love Return of the Jedi.
So same.
Over the years, it went from my favorite as a kid to my least favorite of the three. But I don't think it hits as much. So good. good different list there. Speaking of the Before trilogy, which we mentioned here in this list, Ethan Hawke back in the Black Phone 2, which we will talk about in our main reviews next week. And as always, we will slip some other things in there, which I'm sure we will see throughout the week. I think the there's a couple of random things that hit this week in theaters, kind of on limited release, that I know I'll have a chance to see. I think Frankenstein is in theaters from Guillermo del Toro. And I think there is a few other things too. That Keanu Reeves Angel movie, which I have no interest in.
Yes. Yeah. That's gonna be pretty wide too, I guess, like 3,000 screens, so.
Have you guys seen Aziz Ansari's like antics for the past 2 weeks with this movie?
He showed up at some 10 a.m. screening for something, right? What was it? Was it Tron?
Yeah, it's like he's been showing to like every showing, like Tron, one battle after another, showing like other people's movies and being like, hey, please go see my movie.
They gave like an Uber driver.
If I had Legs, I'd Kick You is also releasing more and more widely too, which I think I'm seeing this week. I go to Alamo Drafthouse here in Texas now. That's kind of my main theater. And Aziz is doing like the pre-movie, like, hey, get your mobile orders in, guys.
Right.
Like,
oh, no. Okay.
Right. Thank you, Aziz Ansari. So, yeah, we'll talk Black Phone 2 and a bunch of other things as well. We'll figure out what our list is. I don't know what our list will be. Horror-related, Ethan Hawke-related, I don't know. Black Phone 1 was good. I don't know about 2. We'll see. That's it. As always, subscribe wherever you're listening or watching. Definitely on YouTube. Also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. We are good on Apple Podcasts now. Tim Apple tried to bring us down. I bought his fucking steelbook too. They finally let us release our podcast on their platform. Like, subscribe wherever you are. For Kirk, Ken Jack, Gooch, Clemmer, I'm Jeff D. Lowe. We will talk to you next week.